ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for Fight Night Picks with your host, Frank
and Matt
Allen.
Big time card coming up this weekend, UFC 278, all the way from Salt Lake City, Utah. We have a big time main event. 6 years, 8 months, and one day in the making between Kamaru Usman, the Nigerian Nightmare, taking on Leon Rocky Edwards. As always, one half of your hosting duo, Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left, to your right, as always, one half of the Bash Brothers, Matt Allen, on the respective socials. Matt Allen, FNP.
I don't want to be Mark McGwire.
Now, Matt, I play first base. We're a little bit less on the juice than those boys. And
yeah.
The juice got squeezed last week because it was not a great week with a card where you have Marlon Vera getting the win over Dominic Cruz, but looking to get back on the horse this week. Of course, we had our Dana White's Contender Series video live on Sunday that you could check out. We've been doing the damn thing the Contender Series. We said, hey, subscriber goal, 30,000. We'll do Contender Series. And we've been having a lot of fun with those live shows, a little bit over 20 minutes, and we are action-packed. But getting set for this weekend, there's a lot of great fights. No rookies on this card, 7 ranked fighters, and you have your champion, Usman, of course. It's one of those ones where a little bit odd, even in your co-main event. Luke Rockhold taking on Paulo Costa, guys who haven't won fights in years in the co-main. You have the greatest featherweight of all time, or at least he's got a claim for it, in the King of Rio, Jose Aldo, taking on the best takedown machine the bantamweight division's ever seen in Marab Dvalishvili, and you'll get a come on Marab out of me. But Matt, I'm very excited about this card because there are some big time prospects featured on this one.
There definitely is, and that's the great thing about a card like this. There's a lot of recognizable names, and there's a lot of names that hopefully will become a lot more recognizable. And I was a little bit down on this pay-per-view upon first review, but I kind of like it now. Like, it's a pretty deep card. Like I said, there's a lot of recognizable names, and it does have a pretty good main event featured at the top. This is my theory, though. I think Utah's using this. I think the Utah Jazz are using this event to try to lure in free agents because they don't have a lot going on right now. They're not really a winning team, but they've got some cap space. So maybe they'll just start holding UFC events more regularly and they'll be like, hey, if you like fights, come play for the Jazz, please. But I do think this is going to be a really fun card to break down.
Should be a great one. We're going to throw it on over to our fight of the night screen last week. Fight of the year, Nate Landwehr, David Onama, that was there. So let us know down below in the comment section who you have, because you have 13 to choose from, and you're not wrong until Saturday night, throwing it on over to the Fight of the Night screen.
Let us know down below in the comment section who you've got. It's time for the Fight of the Night with Fight Night Picks.
First pick, can't get it wrong. I mean, Jose Aldo Marab Dvalishvili, if you look at it for Jose Aldo, he was a WEC legend even before he came into the UFC, set the world on fire, went through that weird stretch from the McGregor fight all the way on through. He's now on a 3-fight win streak, is Aldo, and looking primed and ready for another title shot at 135 this time. Take on Marab Dvalishvili, a man who's landed 50 total takedowns in the bantamweight division. They've credited him for 63 total in his 9-fight UFC career. When you look at the machine in this fight, the guy's an absolute wild man. And even if you just take his last fight as a sample size, he came back from the dead against Magic Marlon Moraes, a fellow Brazilian who's got a wicked left hook just like Jose Aldo, and he was able to get the stoppage win in the second round of that one. I think this fight is going to be banger. Bonkers. Throw out whatever onomatopoeia you want. It's going to be wild until it's not. I think it's going to be a great fight.
This should be an incredible fight, and I feel like it is an obvious choice because, like you said, Marab was just in one of the greatest fights I've ever seen in my life and one of the best comebacks of all time against a guy who fights in an extremely similar manner to Jose Aldo. The only difference is Aldo probably a little bit fresher, which is wild to say just given how long his career's been and just how much damage he really has taken throughout his career. But Aldo does have better cardio than Marlon. I'd say he's more durable than Marlon, so if we get a similar fight to the one Marab just had against Marlon Moraes, but against Jose Aldo, I think we are in for an absolute treat.
And I mean, when you're trying to make a second pick on this one, and we'll run it live on the fly, you guys are going to go, but that's weird. One of these guys is going to get finished. And you might be right. But for Luke Rockhold on the right-hand side, he hasn't won a fight since he absolutely brutalized the former World Series of Fighting double champ David Branch in a fight where he was more than a minus 500 favorite. But you
in
got
Pittsburgh.
To see a glimpse of the old Luke Rockhold, a man who's one of the greatest grapplers in the middleweight division, mixing it up with his excellent striking. But for Luke, I mean, the guy's been on a poster in three of his last four fights. And for the eraser, Paulo Costa, he has lost his last two fights. And when Paulo was in his heyday, 2017, Gareth McClellan, see you later, Oluwole Bamboji, bang, goodbye. And Big Rig Johnny Hendricks go back to owning a steakhouse. So a big opportunity for both of these guys. And if they're at their best, they can definitely put on a great show.
And that's what I'm hoping that we get in this fight. If Luke Rockhold does show up, the best version of himself, he is one of the best offensive grapplers really in the division's history. His top control is really unlike any other fighters we've ever seen. But Paulo Costa don't really play those games. Like, when he fought Yoel Romero, we all know how good of a takedown artist and wrestler Yoel is. And Paulo was able to pop right up when he did get taken down. And he was really competitive in some of those exchanges. So I think if Paulo shows up in as good a shape that he did in the Marvin Vittori fight, which is weird to say because he may have showed up 20 pounds overweight, and I'm sure we'll talk about that more later, I think we are going to get an incredible fight between these two.
Costa beat Romero, Romero beat Rockhold, MMA math, Paulo Costa wins this weekend. Should be a great one. Let us know down below in the comment section who you have. 13 total fights, you're not wrong, until Saturday night, so throw it down below in the comment section. Alright, so not a single rookie on this card. A lot of second looks, especially down below on the prelims. Victor Altamirano unsuccessful in his UFC debut. Jay Perrin unsuccessful against Mario Bautista. Amir Albazi, it's been some time since we've seen him. Both AJ Fletcher and Ange Elosa were unsuccessful in their debuts. Second look for those guys as well. Some fun fights littered throughout. An all-time ledge in Leonardo Santos. Ultimate Fighter winner season Brazil taking on Flash Gordon, and of course rising phenom undefeated heavyweight Alexander Romanov, the king of Conrad, the King Kong himself, taking on Marcin Tybura, former M1 global heavyweight. Matt, I've got a lot to talk about on this card. I think it's going to be a really fun one, and it's one of those ones where I agree with you. You look at it off the page and go, why the hell is Harry Hunsucker on the main card of a pay-per-view in 2022? And then you go, you know what, I kind of like this card. I had a lot of fun with the tape study, so I think it's going to be an enjoyable one.
It should be, and the fun thing about this card is we have a lot of prospects who are on the rise, and we have some other prospects who have sort of faltered as of late, so we're going to really figure out, okay, what are some of these fighters' ceilings moving forward? Like, for Miranda Maverick, people at one point thought, oh, it's just a given she's going to fight for the title, and now people are very much more unsure about what the future of her career is going to look like, whereas Alexander Romanov, we're really in the season of the Romanov, if you will. No one's hotter than Alexander Romanov in the heavyweight division right now, and I feel like there's a lot of other fights that kind of show those same similarities.
Could not imagine showing up to Tiger Muay Thai as a bantamweight and Alexander Romanov's already in the room working a sweat. So we got a big time week coming up with UFC 278. Make sure you check out all of the goings on and the happenings here on YouTube. Dana White's Contender Series. We also have Question Mark Kicks 2 hours before the prelims on the channel, as well as the Fight Night Picks Sidekick. That's going to be during the main card. You can hang out. It's going to be a great time. Here on the YouTubes, Matt, we have a lot to talk about. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Coming up this weekend in the flyweight division, Victor Altamirano is going to want to get out of his split decision ways, having beaten Carlos Candelario on Dana White's Contender Series in a fight where, hey, winner, loser, you're in the show. And then in his UFC debut, a loss to Carlos Hernandez. But if you do look at this matchup, Altamirano gets a willing and game dance partner in Shoot the Box Diego Lima's Daniel Da Silva Lacerda Miojo, and a guy whose nicknames are all over the place, and he is a fighter that can also be all over the place. And if you look at it for Daniel Da Silva, damn Daniel, he doesn't really look like the guy that's in his picture on our screen. So apologies to the people that are listening to the audio podcast on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, because for Da Silva, in his last fight against Francisco Figueiredo, because that's got to be the discount double take of the week when you see each other in the hallways of the Vivint Center there in Salt Lake?
So.
It's so weird that they're in Salt Lake this week. I got to get that one out of the way. But for Daniel Da Silva, he fights Figueiredo, and at the start of that fight, he looked great. Like, his striking was all there. It was tight, because one of the big things with Da Silva, if you're not familiar with him, comes into the UFC with a litany of finishes and a litany of different ways. He's a very wild striker. He's a southpaw. He's really rangy. He came out of ATS Team Tre Rio down in Brazil, which is the main gym of one Alex Oliveira, a guy who had cornered him on the regional scene. And if you watch Da Silva fight, it was just like a smaller version of Oliveira. Very long, bouncy. He throws spinning attacks. He'd go for wild takedowns. He'd get submission finishes. But for Da Silva in the UFC, First fight against one tricky Jeff Molina, a guy who's all the hotness these days.
Exactly.
Da Silva quickly is able to run, grab the back. He had him back mounted, and then just all of a sudden got bucked off. Molina was able to drop him and finish him on the ground. So in his debut, we learned a few things about Da Silva, took on a very high-level competition in Molina. Again, is he a top five fighter right now? Not necessarily, but Molina could very well be there. So for Da Silva's next time out, he gets Figueiredo. And in that fight, you kind of scratch your head, really? Francisco Figueiredo? Like, how are we going to tell how good he looks? Well, he switched gyms from ATS team over to Shoot the Box. He's training with Daniel Willycat. You know him. He is in the UFC by chance. You have Charles Oliveira, Alan Nascimento. And we saw some little changes out of Da Silva where he was still a little reckless with his striking and he was willing to take some liberties. Gets a takedown against Figueiredo, goes to go from half guard to side control, and then out of that, gets his knee wrapped up by Francisco Figueiredo, and it was a quick tap to a knee bar. So for Da Silva, we just haven't seen the best version out of him, and I haven't said a whole lot about Altamirano, but this is a former LFA flyweight champ, debuted as an amateur with LFA at LFA 1, main evented LFA 100, and was able to get the belt there. And for Altamirano, he has a Taekwondo background. Sometimes the takedown defense is good, sometimes it's not very good whatsoever, and he can get caught on the bottom just trying to hold guard and keep his opponent on top of him so that he gets a stand-up by the referee. But I think both these guys match up very well stylistically, and I think it's a good job of matchmaking for unranked flyweights, the, you know, the four or five of them that exist in this world.
Exactly. They should bring out the best versions of each other. And that's the thing about Daniel Da Silva. Everything he does is in pursuit of offense. He's kind of like Trae Young. I guess Trae Young's really good, but you get the idea. He's, again, offensively, he is phenomenal. But defensively, he does struggle in a lot of positions, and he does seem to almost float through some positions. Like, not every strike he throws will be at its maximum potential. He is a very good striker, but sometimes you can sort of wade through the attack and find your own openings. And the thing about his takedowns are they are very explosive, but his top control is not necessarily of the same tier as his wrestling. And that is a little unfortunate, because even if he did have that added wrinkle of his game of just being a heavier opponent in the top position, I think he could have a lot of success, because he does offer the danger from the long range, he does offer the danger from the short range, and then worse things worse, he can then just go for the takedowns. And I do think those takedowns could work against Altamirano, but the problem is I don't know if the type of takedowns Daniel Da Silva does are the type of takedowns that really problem Victor, because with Altamirano, I feel like it's a lot more of the chain wrestling that he'll get stumbled up on. It's less so of the open attacks, single legs. He can get out chain wrestled. He can get out wrestled in general, but his movement does allow him to evade some of those long distance takedowns. And for Da Silva, he does tend to rush in with some of his wrestling exchanges. And I do feel like that could be an area where Altamirano is able to counter and just be the more active guy throughout the three rounds, because I do feel like that is going to be the key to this fight. It's not that Da Silva can't hang with Altamirano on the feet. I don't think that's the case whatsoever, but I do think Altamirano is the more active guy and the busier guy on the feet, and I think those numbers could pile up as this fight continues.
Yeah, like when I'm looking at this for Altamirano, a guy that's trained for a very long time at a V-Fit House of Champions, this one kind of cross-training at peak performance. Watauga, he is a guy that has a really long stance himself. He does tend to throw a lot of volume. He stays kind of flat-footed, but he moves well on his flat feet. There's a lot of fighters that are like that, like think of Jeff Neal. Jeff Neal's halfway flat-footed, but he's able to move in and out very quickly. For Altamirano, somewhat similar, but the thing that I like out of El Magnifico, he doesn't really move his head a lot, but he has really good core movement where he's able to duck and roll with a lot of the punches that he's faced with. The trouble that I have with Altamirano is he tends to kind of find his way in a fight in the first round, get himself in the second round, have a strong third round, whereas Daniel Da Silva, from the jump, he's going hard as it gets in the first round. So if you like Da Silva, he is a first round type of guy. And I mean, I look at this fight as a little bit strange. I mean, originally it was supposed to be Jake Hadley versus Altamirano for this matchup. Back June 15th, it was announced it would be Da Silva versus Altamirano. So pretty well full camp for both guys. Like, really, it is a full camp for both of these men. You have a look at the odds. Altamirano open -225, -215 right now. The odds aren't going to make a whole lot of sense when I read the next one. Da Silva open +165, +172 as it stands. So listen, the odds are towards the fighter originally out of Mexico City, Mexico, in Victor Altamirano. We have a look at the fan vote over on Tapology. Surprise to us as it is to you. And with Altamirano being more than a 2-1 favorite, I'm going to say over under 72.5% Altamirano.
I think it'll be over.
I think it's going to be over. It is over. So 687 total votes, 86% Altamirano, 87% by decision. For the 14% that have Miojo, 60% by decision, 18% by knockout. And if you look at Daniel Da Silva, he is a finisher. So a bit surprising to me that that many fans have him to win by decision if he is to get the win whatsoever. For me in this fight, Matt, for Daniel Da Silva, he's a Swiss Army knife in the first round. The thing that I didn't love about him in his debut, and maybe it was just first fight jitters, but against Jeff Molina, he started out great. He had the back. He was looking for the choke. He got bucked off, and then he kind of struggled once he had his back to the mat. And ultimately, he did get dropped in that one. But the thing that I didn't like, kind of pretty darn tired in the second round. And it's one of those ones where I'm sure you can improve on your cardio. There's fighters on this card that I will talk about later on that have definitely improved on their cardio. I just don't know about Daniel Da Silva. I love the wildness. I love the surprises. He could definitely get the finish. I like the steadier guy in Victor Altamirano to work his Taekwondo from long range to be able to kind of add to his volume numbers and get a win. Not that it's going to be the most fun way to win, but I think Altamirano is going to be able to get it done by decision here.
I do agree with you on Da Silva. It's almost like he has to be taught, hey, you have to run a 5K a lot different than you run a 200 meter because he does sort of sprint from the beginning and it's just not sustainable for anybody to do. Like, nobody in the world can just fight at their maximum potential for 25 minutes straight. You could fight in a similar manner, but no one can go as hard as they possibly can for 25 minutes, and it feels like that's Da Silva's goal, so I do agree with you. I do expect his pace and his output to start to go down as this fight continues, especially in that second and third round, and that's where I definitely do favor Altamirano.
Big time fight coming up this weekend in the flyweight division. Both of us going with Mexico's Victor Altamirano to pick up his first win inside the UFC's octagon. Some big time fights, including our main event, the rematch. 6 years plus in the making, Kamaru Usman taking on Leon Edwards. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Guaranteed banger. Coming up this weekend, UFC 278, we have the Mongolian murderer, Arichi Long, taking on Savage J. Perrin in a matchup of a couple of guys that are willing to bang. It's Julian Lane type of fight. And for Jay Perrin, he came in on 5 days notice to make his UFC debut against Mario Bautista.
That's a tough ask for anybody.
Yeah, it was like taking a credit card and putting it in a paper shredder and going, ooh, ah, well, that was fun and really, really awkward. And for Jay Perrin, he wasn't able to get the win, but he is the former Cage Titans and CS Bantamweight champion. And for Perrin, he kind of invites the damage in a lot of his fights. And I know I kind of sound like somebody who's trying to butter you up for a Justin Gaethje fight, but that very much is the manner that you're going to see Jay Perrin succeed. He's going to mix in the takedowns. He's going to give one to take one. And, you know, out of 15 total fights, 2/3 of those fights, he's won. Right, Matt? You think that's fair?
Is that what you want your legacy to be known? 15 men have tried and 5 have succeeded? I mean, it's better than being Artem Lobov.
Like, I wouldn't be surprised if Jay Perrin walked into the cage and on his way in with Syndicate MMA, John Wood went, you know what, I'm going to take a book out of the Clay Guida playbook and we're just going to start slapping him to get him ready for this fight.
It probably would fire him up.
Well, he's going to be taking on China's Arichi Long, a guy who spent time at Fight Ready, Haile Alatang at that gym that you will recognize, but there is, of course, Korean Zombie, Eddie Cha being the coach, Santino DeFranco. And we saw that out of Arichi Long, his last fight, training out of the gym. Well, he was able to get the win. And I mean, looking at Arichi Long coming into the UFC, kind of a give one to take one type of fighter, fights in a fight of the night at UFC 261. That was, of course, an Usman headline card. He took on Jeff Molina. Now, did he get dropped twice in the second round? Yeah. Did he get completely outstruck in the third round? Kind of. I mean, it was a lot of volume from Jeff Molina, but Arichi Long just kept marching forward, throwing power shots of his own.
Isolate those last 9 seconds and tell me who won the fight.
Yeah, I mean, if you just watch the highlight pack, it was Arichi Long's fight to lose. And if you look at his next fight, takes on Cody Durden, gets taken down early, but he rallied as that fight went along. So his last time out, he goes in there, he takes on Cameron Eltz. And it's got to be awkward, because for Jay Perrin, he trains out of Syndicate, and Cameron Eltz is probably whispering sweet nothings into his ear at Syndicate, telling him how to win, but it wasn't successful for poor old Cameron Eltz in that matchup. Arichi Long looked great there, he was able to push his striking, and he has been an all-action type of fighter, so I really like this fight. Don't really know where either guy goes from here, and the other thing that I have to say, have it as 22-9 on the screen for Arichi Long. He was not 23 or 22-9 before his last fight. He was 18-9 before he fought Cameron Eltz. So just like Shailan Nordambeka, there's a few extra wins that got added to the record. But for Richie Long, I mean, the guy's the same guy that he thought.
Like, how old is Albert Pujols? That's the real question. I think this is going to be an incredible fight. I really do. I have been getting up for these Richie Long fights in the UFC, and I didn't really know what we were going to get. And if I'm being honest, I do agree with you. Like, I don't really know what we are going to get moving forward from this point. But they're all going to be entertaining fights. I can pretty much guarantee you that. It was a little bit disappointing, though, to see him struggle so much against Durden in the wrestling, because I really thought just with his overall movement and his ability to put punches on guys as they move in recklessly for the takedown, I thought he'd have a lot more success in that matchup. But the fact that once Durden was able to get those takedowns early and secure them, Archie Long didn't really have much of an answer off his back or in his own terms of counter wrestling. And that was an area that if you had watched before he came into the UFC, he did wrestle a little bit more, and he did wrestle a lot more up against the cage too. So I will be interested to see, goodness, if he can hang with Jay Perrin in some of these wrestling encounters, because I think Perrin is going to struggle on the feet just due to the fact that he does load up a little bit more on his shots. And I think while he's loading up, he is going to be eating 1, 2, 3 shots from Archie Long that they might not hurt him. They might not necessarily put him away, even though Archie Long does have good power. But I do think that they're at least going to be enough of a deterrent for Jay Perrin to just rush in recklessly and really have enough success with his takedowns. Because let's say he just gets a lot of top control and not a lot of damage off if he is on top, I don't think Archie Long is then going to be a different fighter in the second and third round. Whereas if Jay Perrin does expend a lot of energy in some of these wrestling exchanges in the first round, I don't know if he is going to be able to hang with the output late of Archie Long.
Yeah, I mean, if you watch Jay Perrin on Dana White's Contender Series back in 2019, he took on Dwight Joseph, and in that matchup, he continued with the takedowns and the volume, and a lot of people thought that Perrin won that fight, and Joseph came out on the winning end, and we haven't really seen much of Dwight Joseph since. And if we do look at it, I mean, yeah, that is kind of the trouble for Jay Perrin. He does kind of get caught on the feet. He doesn't really check a lot of leg kicks. That can be a giant detriment. But the thing that I like out of him, we talk about this with usually like one or two fighters every weekend, he's pretty darn good at mixing his martial arts. When he wants to wrestle, he wrestles, grapple, strike. He can really do that very well. So I look at Richie Long, a couple extra wins on the record, whether it's 22-9 when it went to make the graphic, as most sites had it, now it's 23-9. Fortune, fame, mirror, vain, gone insane, the memory remains. Richie Long's kind of the same fighter to me, so just like the old Metallica lick. Wow. But I look at the odds here. Richie Long open a minus 300. He is a minus 185 favorite in the matchup right now. Jay Perrin open plus 250, plus 153 or thereabouts. We have a look at the Tapology votes. They're a surprise to us as they are to you. I said in the last matchup, minus 200 or so, 72.5%. I'm going to do it again for Richie Long, over under 72%.
I'll say under.
And say under. It's over 727 total votes, 88% Richie Long, 58% by decision, 37% by knockout. For the 12% that have Perrin, 76% by decision. Surprised that more people aren't picking Jay Perrin in this fight. And again, I know I said it at 72% or so, but for Perrin, he has that wrestling advantage over a lot of guys in the bantamweight division. He usually has a bit of a size advantage over most guys. So wrestling and size can win you a lot of fights in this division until you get to the upper echelon. And bantamweight is of that ilk right now. You saw that in the main event last weekend with Dominic Cruz's nose. Looked like Roger Huerta's
nose. There's like 10 guys in that division who could be champ any other weekend.
It's wildness. But I look at this fight. I like the volume out of Richie Long. I like the ability to mix up his power shots with the rest of his volume. I like him in this matchup for that reason. I would not be surprised, though, if Jay Perrin puts on a wrestling clinic and gets a decision win on his own.
That's definitely the path of victory for Jay Perrin, and I do expect him to have some success with his wrestling early on.
But in a full camp, too, right?
Exactly. But at a certain point, I do think the pace of Archie Long will eventually get to him, and I don't think it's going to be via TKO or anything like that. I do believe this is probably going to be a decision either way, but if it comes down to the wrestling of Perrin or the overwhelming volume of Archie Long, I'm going to end up siding with the overwhelming volume of Archie Long.
Great training partners for Jay Perrin at Syndicate include Vince Morales, who was in his corner the last time, Cameron Eltz, who had just fought Richie Long, Brandon Jenkins.
Ooh.
And Jordan Levitt. So good opportunity for Jay Perrin to get the win coming up this weekend. Both of us siding with the Mongolian murderer, too aggressive, Richie Long to get the win. Big time card coming up this weekend, including Paulo Costa versus Luke Rockhold. Not a fight happening in 2018. It's happening in 2022. And in the main event, Kamaru Usman taking on Leon Edwards. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. The long-awaited return of the Prince Amir Albazi getting into his first bit of action since January of 2021, taking on the sniper, Francisco Figueiredo, who's coming off his first performance bonus in his UFC career, a first-round knee bar win over Daniel Da Silva, who's also in this card. And for Amir Albazi, if you do look at it in his last fight, I mean, obviously, first of all, we got to get it out of the way. Undefeated in the UFC. Now, he is only 2-0, win over Malcolm Gordon. He was able to get that one done. And win over that gritty guy out of Kazakhstan, Zhalga Zhumagulov. And in that matchup, kind of a bit of a back and forth in the first round. In the second round, the third round, Albazi starting to pull away. And we saw some different wrinkles out of Albazi's game because primarily known as a grappler, I know he fought out of London Shoot Fighters for the longest time. He's been based in the States at Extreme Couture ever since that fight. And if you do look at it for Albazi, very good friendship that he has with Javid Basharat, also out of London Shoot Fighters. Now they're both out of Extreme Couture. And if you go on Amir, this is going to sound weird. If you go on Amir Albazi's YouTube page, he's got like a behind the scenes, like a Road to UFC type documentary production crew following him around. Now, he had that set up before he was supposed to take on Tim Elliott, before he was supposed to take on Ode Osborne. Those fights fell out, and I watched it, and Albazi kind of said, I had some injuries. Well, you've been out since January 2021. Tried to get to the bottom of it, tried to sleuth it, couldn't find much. I mean, he says, like, I get injured, and these injuries, da-da-da, and there's one where they're kind of working on, looks like a kind of a hip flexor, just kind of stretching him out. There was one where they were cupping him on the back, and he was kind of working out his neck, but they all seem pretty pedestrian to me. But it's just been disappointing that we haven't seen Albazi in such a long time, because he is a ranked fighter in this division. He's still young enough. I mean, he is 28 right now, but he is one of the more recognizable prospects. It's 100%. Just, we haven't seen him in a while. And the added wrinkle that we saw in the Zhumagulov fight was, Albazi kind of stood up really straight and decided, hey, I'm a boxer now, which isn't going to work against Francisco Figueiredo. For Figueiredo, he strikes like he's holding a steel brush mower in his hands. He's one of those low hands.
He just looks like an 1890s boxer.
Kind of like Blood Diamond does. Really low hands, really good kickboxer. I mean, he strikes from the southpaw stance, throws great kicks to the body, great kicks to the head. Very much a single-shot striker, not much of a boxer like his brother Davison can be. But for Figueiredo, where the bread gets buttered in the UFC, it's been on the ground. So if you look at it for Figueiredo, comes into the UFC, beats Jerome Rivera in a weird fight, and I can go through that fight six ways to Sunday, loses to Malcolm Gordon. Well, Amir Albazi beat Malcolm Gordon, so the argument's done. MMA Math says that Sweden's Amir Albazi gets the win this weekend.
That's he should, though. Works. Let's be honest. Like, Amir Albazi was a very exciting prospect at one point. Like you said, if you want to still consider him a prospect, you probably can. Like, I won't hold it against you. But he is a ranked fighter at this point, and he is looking to make his way up the division. It just feels like a strange fight matchmaking-wise to me to put Francisco Figueiredo in a position like this. I know he is coming off of a good performance, and if you do look at it, he is 2-1 in the UFC, but he did struggle immensely against Malcolm Gordon. And the problem was, the fight kind of slipped away from him as it went late. And against a guy like Amir Albazi, who can not only weaponize his wrestling, but his cardio too, I think Francisco Figueiredo is really going to struggle in a high-output type of fight that Amir Albazi likes to be in. The only thing is, if Albazi does show up trying to be that sort of pedestrian, if you will, or just basic boxer that he kind of showed in his last fight, I think he could struggle against Francisco Figueiredo. But the weird thing about Figueiredo is, his shots look a lot more damaging than they have been in the UFC. Like, he cocks up on some huge shots, and they do land, but he doesn't necessarily seem to have the best power in the division. I don't necessarily look at him as a guy who can put a guy down with one shot, even though that tends to be the manner in which he strikes. It would be nicer if he could put more punches together, go to the body a little bit more, because his strikes do look good in those freeze frames if you just want to look at the single strikes. The problem is there's nothing to set up the power shot, and then after the power shot, there's nothing else if he can't find the chin off that initial shot. So if Figueiredo does show up with a higher level of output, I would like him a lot more as a fighter, because I think he is going to struggle a lot in the wrestling in this matchup. So if he does struggle with the wrestling, and if he's not able to get some off the back submission, which is extremely difficult to do at the UFC level, especially against a guy like Amir Albazi with his level of grappling, I think Figueiredo is going to have to find a way to just do some damage on the feet to stop the forward pressure of Amir Albazi. So hopefully that is something that he has worked on in camp. Again, his strikes are good, but here's the problem with that long stance. A lot of guys who do use that sort of karate open stance bounce on their feet and have really good footwork. Figueiredo can kind of have stationary feet. It's sometimes trying to set up his power shot. And I think that if Albazi's moving forward, that's the perfect time to catch him off guard, go low, take out the hips, and really be able to use his own grappling offensively.
And if you look at it for Figueiredo, he's been susceptible to the takedown in the UFC, the Malcolm Gordon fight, the weird fight that he had against Jerome Rivera in the debut. If you look at it for me, I mean, good takedowns, good takedown defense in the Rivera fight. I thought Figueiredo won round one, round two. Round three, I mean, my God, he didn't look very good. And then against Malcolm Gordon, loses round one, loses round three, wins round two, and then his last time out against tricky Daniel Da Silva, he's able to get that knee bar submission after he got outstruck and he got taken down. But as Da Silva's going from half guard to side control, he's able to just cinch up the knee and really quickly.
It was impressive.
That was the loudest snap of my fingers I've ever done in my life. So apologies to the podcast fans, but Figueiredo was able to sync that one up. I mean, he does have a career loss in 2011 to one of the greatest smaller fighters of all time. I'm talking Hands of Stone, John Lineker, one championship champion. But if we do look at the odds in this one, Albazi open a minus 300 favorite. If you've been out for almost 2 years, that's silly. He's a minus 170 favorite right now. Figueiredo open plus 250, plus 286 as it stands. So the odds are kind of all over the place from minus 300 to minus 370 and plus 250 to plus 286. If we have a look at the Tapology mats, Tapology votes, Matt. I'm getting ahead of myself. I'm so excited about Albazi Figueiredo. I'm going to say over under 80% Albazi.
I think it's going to be over. I expect him to be the overwhelming favorite.
He's way over. 720 votes, 94% Albazi, 41% by decision, 49% by submission. For the 6% that have Figueiredo, 45% by submission. Amir Albazi, six-time Swedish Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu champion, gi and no gi. And that really is the bread that gets buttered. But the best part about his jiu-jitsu is the fact that he has the wrestling setup. So that's what you love out of his game. And listen, yes, does he have a career loss to Jose Shorty Torres at the highest level over with Brave? Yes, he does. That's the only loss he has on his record.
That's perfectly fine.
By decision. But if you do look at it for Albazi, I do like what I've seen. I think Extreme Couture is the camp. I don't want to see his boxing. I don't want to see it. I saw it in his last fight against Shumagulov. He was really high up, like he stood very, very straight up, and it's one of those spots where you're taking on a guy like Figueiredo, even as a smaller guy being Albazi, you're going to get kicked to the head, you're going to get kicked to the body. So I do like Albazi based on the wrestling and grappling. Figueiredo's got a good shot in this one, and he's a pretty big underdog here too.
What I will say about Albazi striking in his defense, although I do in large part agree with what you just said, at a certain point we are going to have to see that evolution in his game. So maybe the last fight was just sort of the first step, and then maybe he will look slightly more improved in this fight, because it has been a while since he's been in there. He's had a lot of time to train. Hopefully those injuries weren't too severe. So maybe Albazi can show up and improve upon the striking that he showed in his last matchup. So hopefully it would be really nice to see that, honestly. Like, Albazi at one point was looked at as like a future top five guy, maybe because of his activity, because of his grappling acumen. So I do think that he is still that exciting kind of a fighter he once was. And I think if he is able to beat Figueiredo, which I do expect him to do, it'll just sort of be the next step in becoming that.
Canadians can get on board with this one. For Amir Albazi, his fight against Jaga Shumagulov was like going to Eastside Mario's, where they sit you down, they give you the bread, they give you the salad, and then you wait 45 minutes until you get your chicken parm. For Amir Albazi, we got the entree, we've waited for about a year and a half, and now we finally get that chicken parm against Francisco Figueiredo. Both of us going
Eastside Mario's. I
with
be
Sweden and Iraq's own Amir Albazi to get the win. I think it's going to be an entertaining fight at 125. We have a big time main event between Kamaru Usman and Leon Edwards in the rematch, so you're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. Unsuccessful in their respective UFC debuts, we have a pair of fighters looking to right the ship. We have Louisiana's own AJ Fletcher taking on Congo and Switzerland's Ange Losa. And Matt, when you look at this one, we got the Ghost and the Last Ninja looking to remain transparent and outsmart their opponents inside of the cage. Nickname for AJ Fletcher is the Ghost, and he says on his UFC.com Q&A page that his coach gave him that nickname because he doesn't tan very well.
He is
very
a pale
transparent
man, and I can relate.
Yeah, so can I. I'm red as hell because of the sun. And for Ange Losa, this is a guy coming into the UFC that it not necessarily was a big head-scratcher because he had a fun fight against Jack Della. Being on short notice there, he then ends up getting a win over Titan FC. Gets a win over Titan FC against Colin Lubberts. That was a Dana White looking for a fight card. On the show against Jack Della, loses. He beats UFC veteran John Howard with XMMA, and then he ends up in the UFC a very short time after against Munir Lazez. The trouble for Losa in the fight against Lazez Lazenz is a long-range striker at welterweight, and Lusa wasn't able to kind of charge that gap and start to land his own shots, where Lusa's a great guy. He can fight behind a jab, throws a really good right hand, mixes his martial arts very well. He's good with the takedown. And if you go back and look at Ange Lusa's total body of work, because he's had long periods of inactivity throughout, the fight that I urge you to go back and find, and it is out there, is the fight against Rustam Khasanov, where he beats him pillar to post. Khasanov gets his back. The referee taps on Khasanov's back. The crowd goes, what the hell's going on? Khasanov gets off the back where he's got his hands locked, and he is completely dead to rights done. He drops down to the mat. The camera zooms in on his face as he's nearly in.
It's effed up. I'm not going to lie.
He's on death's door in that one.
This sport's really messed up sometimes.
Lusa's announced the winner, but I think Lusa, very, very good striker. It's fire versus fire in this matchup because AJ Fletcher is cut from the same cloth. He's got a biology degree from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. But for Fletcher, he was a guy that had his sights set on football and had to settle for MMA. But settling for MMA got him 9-0 coming into the UFC. Got a flying knee win on Dana White's Contender Series against Damiani last year. And then in his debut, he takes on Matt Semelsberger. Beats him pillar to post in the first round.
Tough guy to fight in your debut.
Second round, third round, wasn't really able to get it done. But for Fletcher, I mean, I think he gained a lot of fans and a lot of stock in that debut. And we learned a little bit more out of him, I think, in that fight because he is such a quick guy in the octagon when he does get the chance.
He showed so much promise in that fight against Semelsberger. At least I thought so, especially in that first round. His takedown to mount was about like 3 seconds. He really did look good transitioning from position to position on the mat. And I think that's something that if he can improve more upon, he could become a really dangerous fighter. And that's the fun thing about this fight. I feel like both guys have a potentially high ceiling, but the loser of this is probably going to get written off, and that's going to be the unfortunate thing.
Yeah, it's a weird one. Like, you look at Ange Lusa being 2-3 in his last 5 fights, and that's not good, especially making your UFC debut.
And he only beat John Howard, who in this year isn't the biggest deal.
But a split decision loss almost 4 years ago, went over Colin Lubberts, and then he takes that really long period off. He loses by decision to Jack Della, beats John Howard, and then loses 3 months ago to Munir Lazez. And if you look at it for Fletcher, not the greatest level of competition, no, but winning consistently. I mean, he beat Wesley Golden, who was 8-17. He beat Ariel Juarez, who was 3-4. He beat Damiani, who was 10-2-1, but it was 10-2-1. But I don't want to take anything away from Fletcher because when you watch him strike, he loads up and throws tons of power shots. But when he works in his wrestling, he's not a guy with a high school or collegiate wrestling background. But to watch him fight, you think, geez, this guy's great. I mean, 1 of 2 of takedowns against Semelsberger in the first round. 4 minutes and 31 seconds of control times. The total strikes in round 1 against Semelsberger, 22-2.
Yeah.
Lit him on fire. And Semelsberger, I know the Morono fight, it is what it is. Two totally different kind of guys. But Fletcher did look very good. And I totally agree with you. We did learn even more about him. A guy that's trained with Alan Joban and Dustin Poirier. Not just like one time for a picture on Instagram. They've trained together quite a bit. So you look at this fight, Matt. Killcliffe FC's own Ange Lusa. You've got the man out of Louisiana in Fletcher. What more can you tell us about the matchup?
I think that Fletcher can have success on the feet, but that's the problem. It really does come down to the Daniel Da Silva effect, if you will. When you burn as hot as AJ Fletcher does, especially in the first round, it is hard to sustain that throughout a 15-minute fight. And I don't think Ange Lusa is going to have the same issue that he did in the Munir Lazez fight. Because you're right, Lazez did move around quite a bit in that matchup, so it's difficult for Lusa to close the distance and really have success. Whereas AJ Fletcher is normally the one trying to get into all these striking engagements, so I think Lusa is going to have a much easier time finding his opponent in this game. The problem is, if he's not able to really masterfully counter some of these big explosions from AJ Fletcher, I could see Lusa being on the receiving end of some of these takedowns. And if he does give away that first round, that's going to put a lot of pressure on him to come back and win the last two. And I think that that might be something he struggles with, even though, again, this fight's going to be one of those contender pretender ones, because the winner's probably going to go on to have a lot more exciting fights in the UFC, where the loser's probably going to get lost in your overall, like, MMA mindset. But still, I do think this is going to be a highly competitive and exciting fight, just due to the potential finishing abilities of both fighters.
Fletcher throws hammers. We know this. We've seen this kind of on his come up into the UFC. He utilizes his great wrestling against Semelsberger, so the fight IQ is definitely there. Tall stance for the not the tallest guy. I know they list both these guys as 5'10". When they weigh in and face off on Friday, we're going to get to see who the real 5'10 is.
I think we're getting Jarzinho Francis.
And for Lusa in that debut against Munir Lazez, that was on 4 days' notice, replacing Eliseu Zaleski dos Santos. And if you like one thing out of Lusa, 1-2-3 jab, right hand. He landed 40 of 48 attempts at the leg kicks in that fight, and that really is a big part of his game. He really does move well on the balls of his feet. And to me, he beat a wrestler in John Howard, who is... he's
so old.
If he's anything now, he's a wrestler. Very, very nice guy.
I'm sure he is. But the problem, like, I'm sure Carmelo Anthony's a great guy too, but he's been 19 seasons in the league.
And he would beat the piss off of you in a one-on-one.
Okay, who cares? I'm just a guy. That's a weird thing to say.
Matt Allen, just a guy. Put it on the poster. Matt Allen, we look at the odds for this one. AJ Fletcher, open a minus 190 favorite. Minus 160 right now, the lone loss UFC debut. For Losa, open plus 165, plus 152. We have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. Surprise to us, they are to you. I know the odds are closing in, getting closer to par. I don't think the fan vote's going to be close at all. I'm going to say over under 80% AJ Fletcher for the Ghost.
I think it'll be close to 50-50. I'll say under.
I think so. We're going to find out. Not that close, but closer to the 80%. Still under. 697 total votes. 76% Fletcher. 77% by decision for the 24% that have Losa. 76% by decision. So a lot of people thinking this one's going to go to a decision. And for Losa, we've seen that recently. For Fletcher, he's a finisher. So it's kind of a surprise to me that we have that many taking Fletcher to win by decision in this one.
I'm a little surprised by that too, but I do think he can have success even with his single shot style. It's just really going to come down to Ange Losa and his ability to defend those first few takedowns, because if Fletcher is able to get them successfully and spend a lot of time on top, I don't really expect him to tire that much throughout this fight. Whereas if he is getting some defended, forced to expend a lot of his energy in some of the striking, I could see his pace start to fall off as the fight continues. So this fight really does come down to the first 2 or 3 minutes, I do believe, to see how both guys hold up in the wrestling. I'm ever so slightly going to pick AJ Fletcher because I do think he is going to be able to get some of those early takedowns and have success. Matthew Semelsberger, I know, struggled with the striking of Alex Barona his last time out, but he's a pretty darn good wrestler. And the fact that AJ Fletcher was able to go out there and immediately get on top of him and not just take him down like Jon Jones, Daniel Cormier, where it's really quick and they pop right up to their feet. He took him down and controlled him for a lengthy amount of time in that round. And I think for those reasons, I saw enough of a glimpse of a prospect to think that AJ Fletcher can get it done this weekend.
Do you think that AJ Fletcher at home in his office has a globe just sitting on his desk and goes, spins it, points right on it, goes, I'm the former Atlas world champion at welterweight. You think he does that?
That'd be real cheesy if he did.
I'd do it if I was him. He is the former Atlas champion. I love those leg kicks out of Ange Losa. I love the movement and I love the volume. So if he's able to at least sprout back up to his feet, keep a good pace throughout 3 rounds, which I've seen before, I think Ange Losa can get it done as the underdog in this matchup. I think this is a great fight. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of fans going either way with this one. We want to hear from you down below in the comments section. Great fight between a couple of unranked welterweights. And up at the top, the champs. The champs are here. Well, one of them's a champ and the other one wants to become that. Kamaru Usman taking on Leon Edwards. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. This weekend, a battle between Invicta Phoenix Series Rising number 2 participants, and this is actually the rematch of that. We have Fear Thee, Miranda Maverick, taking on the Shanimal, changed the nickname, Shanna Young, who switched up camps here recently, found success in her last fight with that switch up, a finish win over Gina Mazzani. Back mounted, hammering away, TKO, big win for the Shanimal, her first win in a meaningful amount of time, because before that, a win over Maiju Suotama back 2 years and 9 months ago. And for Shanna Young, it's been an odd run. I mean, she loses to Sarah Alpar in Dana White's Contender Series, loses to Macy Chasson in a short notice debut, loses to Stephanie Egger, and in all of those fights, it was the threat of the takedown that was really her downfall. And if you do look at it in the original fight between Shanna Young and Miranda Maverick, they didn't have any time to train for each other. It was the luck of the draw in the tournament. Maverick goes out there with her southpaw stance, tries to throw some strikes. Shanna Young stood a little bit taller than she normally does. She usually keeps a low base against wrestlers. She was starting to work her strikes. Maverick went for one, and then she was kind of on her tippy toes. Shanna Young pushes her with a jab. Kind of stumbles her backwards. Maverick trying to gain her balance. Young initiates a clinch. Maverick gets down to the mat. As Young's trying to get back up against the fence, Maverick gets the back, then sinks in the choke. And then Miranda Maverick's kind of off to the races. And for Shanna Young, it's kind of been a little bit of a mixed bag. Now, I do have this for Shanna Young, that big camp change over to Syndicate MMA. That really did kind of light a fire back under her. She used to be a fighter out of Knoxville Martial Arts, the Kings, Emily and Jason out of that gym. You have OSP there as well. But for Shanna Young, She's a bit of an odd duck because she has a high school and collegiate background in wrestling. We don't really see that in her fights. But then she also has a karate background, and that very much is the kind of, you know, where the bread gets buttered in most of her game. It's an odd stance that we don't see very often.
That's the weird thing about MMA. Like, you can have all the accolades in one given martial art that you want, but then you don't really translate it all that well to mixed martial arts. It's just really weird how some people can sort of use their base in a much more effective manner. Like, think of a Gilbert Burns, for instance. He comes from a much higher level background, but still, his jiu-jitsu outside the cage, on the streets, if you will, pretty good. His jiu-jitsu in the cage, also very good. But for Young, I always did expect more from her offense with her takedowns, but just feels like defensively she is such a liability that, like you said, even in a lot of these clinches, she doesn't even look that comfortable in them because she's always going to have to worry about the offensive disadvantage that she's going to have in the wrestling. And for Maverick, I kind of expect her to just go back to the same thing she did in their first fight. And I do feel like she's improved more since their first fight. And I know that might be weird because they have very similar records since then. They're both 1-2 in their last three. But Miranda Maverick has had close competitive fights against fairly good fighters in the division, whereas Young has just struggled so much with the defense, with her takedowns, that I don't really know how she's ever going to fix that whole in her game. Like, I don't know if Shayna Young's ever going to be able to get past that learning curve of her wrestling defense, because I'll give her striking credit. If she is able to keep it on the feet, she does have pretty good power for the division. She is good offensively with her takedowns, but the issue is, Miranda Maverick has shown the ability to defend a lot of takedowns, and she does have decent takedown defense late into fights. So if you're a Shayna Young believer, you might be hanging your hat on, okay, Miranda Maverick might not look great as this fight continues. Maybe she almost looks too good in the first two rounds, but I just don't know what Shayna Young is going to do to have a long, sustainable game plan in this matchup.
Like, Shayna Young in her last fight against Gina Mazzani, round number one, Mazzani was a woman possessed. She landed one of those knees in the clinch that dropped Shayna Young, like when Uriah Hall fought Paulo Costa, because Young just dropped her knees to the mat and then popped right back up really quick. And then Mazzani was out of juice. The Energizer Bunny ran dry. And then the second round, Shayna Young was really able to take over. So credit where it is due, because defending a takedown, forcing the action on the mat, finishing it in a spot where Mazzani's usually able to flow. You remember the fight against Rachel Ostovich that Gina Mazzani had. Wow. Really going back into the memory bank there. For Miranda Maverick, though, again, I mean, we have seen some big fights here. She does a good job with her double legs in open space, running the pipe, continuing to pressure forward with those takedowns and some big beatdowns in certain fights. And for Maverick in the UFC, the loss to Macy Barber by split decision, most people thought Maverick won, but it's still lost on the page. The loss to Erin Blanchfield, which was kind of a cobbled together short notice affair where Blanchfield was the favorite and was really able to win all over the place. The fight against Sabina Mazo, a little bit of strike for strike, but it really was a big time beatdown. Round one, round two, poor Sabina Mazo. So in this matchup, Matt, Miranda Maverick, pretty big favorite, open minus 350, minus 421 as it stands. For Shayna Young, open plus 285, plus 322. If we've learned anything from last weekend, big favorites don't always win on the Vera Cruz card. We have a look at the topology votes, Matt. Surprise to us there to you. I'm going to say over under 85% Miranda Maverick.
I'll say over. I think it'll be like 95 or
setting
wild.
These really high. Yeah, it's way over. So 759 total votes, 98% Maverick, 61% by decision, 27% by submission, 6% by knockout. For the 2% that have Shayna Young, 93% by decision. When you look at this fight, Matt, I mean, for Shayna Young, finally gets a full camp for Miranda Maverick, so you can kind of throw out the first fight. For Miranda Maverick, a bit of the same thing. But out of Maverick, what I do like, the fact that Maverick's switching up camps. Now she's kind of seemed to have found a home at Pound for Pound Muay Thai. Justin Houghton, the coach. You have Tisha Torres over there. You saw getting ready for the Lauren Murphy fight against Miesha Tate. Maverick was a main training partner for Lauren Murphy. That one worked out great for her. I also have some more names. Mallory Martin, Dana White's Contender Series. Haley Cowan is at that gym as well. So you do like to see that. But out of Shayna Young, that tricky, like, side kick, front kick that she throws, that's one that can keep a lot of these ladies away from her. But in a matchup like this, I assume Maverick's going to be able to close the distance and take this one to the mat.
And that's the thing. I don't think Miranda Maverick's even going to struggle on the in-betweens of finding a way to go from striking to her wrestling. She does have good Muay Thai on the outside. She can throw the elbow. That's the only thing that is wild to me. Like, John Anik, you're a really smart guy. I like you a lot. But remember when he was like, after she beat Luana Jojua, he was like, this might be the second best flyweight.
I think we all thought that. When she beat Jillian Robertson, like, she's off to the races.
But after you beat Jojua, I don't think anyone's like, wow, she's the only person better than than her in this division is Valentina Shevchenko. Like, there's a very big distance between those two. That's all. I still think she is a promising prospect. The only person who has convincingly beat her in the UFC was Erin Blanchfield. And Erin Blanchfield is another top-tier prospect, borderline contender at this point. So there's really no shame in that loss whatsoever. And I do expect the more well-rounded and the younger, goodness, Miranda Maverick to have a lot more success in this matchup.
Excited for the fight. Also excited for Erin Blanchfield versus Molly McCann, a fight that's actually going to happen. Both of us going with Fear the Miranda Maverick, now training out of Colorado to beat Syndicate's Shanna the Shanimal Young. Big time card coming up this weekend. Main event for the title at 170. Kamaru Usman looking to defend against Leon Rocky Edwards. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Coming up this weekend, I only have two questions about this fight. Can Sean Woodson outlast fight ready's Luis Saldana, or can Luis Saldana go into the well like the gym's own JSP, Jonathan Pierce, and eke out a win over Sean Woodson? I mean, you look at this matchup, we have Sean Woodson, a guy who has one pro boxing fight. I'll show it. I mean, he fought at 215 pounds. The viewers get to see what he looked like. Matt, Sean Woodson, I mean, looking out for the crew.
That doesn't even look like the same man.
They don't even look the same. But it's crazy to see that this guy, I mean, obviously, it's been well documented. He had a car accident when he was a young man. It forced him to go from boxing over to MMA. And I mean, Matt, he's only lost one fight. And in that fight, he was winning it until Julian Erosa went snap down city. I'm snapping this one down to the mat, and I'm going to get him caught in a Darce choke. And Woodson was out of that one. But for Woodson in the UFC, he has looked very good. Of course, the only thing that I can say is he's just not very active. I mean, that's my one knock. He gets the win on Contender Series against Terrence McKinney 3 years ago. McKinney was winning that fight with the wrestling exchanges until, as he's getting up, got a little bit lazy. Flying knee by Woodson finishes him in that one. A win over Kyle Bochniak in a hometown fight for Bochniak. Great motion, great volume out of Woodson in that one. Gets a win over Yusuf Zalal by split decision and beat Colin Anglin about 6 months ago. Colin Anglin has not looked good outside of the UFC. I thought he was going to be good with his wrestling. Anglin tried to strike with Woodson.
Bad idea.
And he was not able to get it done. But for Woodson, you see exactly what the base is. I mean, he's St. Louis's own. He really does mix in that boxing very well. He's probably one of the better pure boxers you're going to find in MMA. You see him always moving his feet, always moving his hands. He's not really a guy that utilizes a lot of peekaboo, but there always is moving pieces to his game. The nickname is the Sniper, and he throws such volume and puts power at the end of his shots that it's just so hard for a lot of guys to figure him out. And very much like a lot of pure kickboxers that come into MMA, where you're labeled as a pure boxer and you're so big and long and lanky, a lot of guys are going to go and take you down. And he's had good takedown defense throughout his overall career. So Woodson comes into this one against a guy who is obviously much more well-rounded than Luis Saldana. And the only thing I have to say about Saldana, you look at this guy, I mean, at one point in his career, he was 10-6 back in 2017. Since then, he's 6-1. You look at the one loss that he has in the UFC against Austin Lingo, lose the decision. Really slows down in the third round, gets dropped. You look at it in the debut against Jordan Griffin. That was one of the most controversial fights going. MMA decisions, 2 had it, 29-28 Saldana. 16 had it, 29-28 for Jordan Griffin. And you look at his last fight against Bruno Souza, the same thing can be said because 6 had it, 29-28 Saldana. 7 had it, 29-28 Bruno Souza. The problem for Luis Saldana is trying to conserve his gas tank and when to decide to conserve his gas tank, because he can burn pretty damn hot early on, but then he's forced to pay for it as the fight goes on. I thought he had a pretty good third round against Bruno Souza. Round one, round two, they could have both gone Souza's way. So for Saldana, it's just trying to figure it out because he definitely is a more complete martial artist in this matchup
here. And I think he's really going to have to rely on the leg kicks in this matchup because since he does have by far the worst cardio in between these two, I think he's going to struggle later on in this fight. But if he does invest enough in those water in the bank techniques, to quote Teddy Atlas, I think it could sort of even that gap as this fight goes late. For Saldana, he does have really nice kicks. He has a good front kick up the middle. He has good leg kicks, so I do expect that to be a weapon that he uses quite a bit in this matchup. I just don't know how Sean Woodson's going to deal with the overall activity of Luis Saldana, especially early. I think this is going to be an incredibly competitive and entertaining fight, if I'm being honest. Like, this probably could be a headline stealer on the prelims, just because Sean Woodson, when he does win, it's normally by a flashy, high-level strike. He is very heavy-handed, not just a heavy man, as you see in the picture to my left. left. So for Woodson, I do think he can have a lot of success on the feet, but you're right, his lack of volume is very concerning. He either tends to win by this highlight reel finish, or he'll win a pretty close fight that by the end of it, you're sort of worried if he is going to win the decision or not. And against a guy like Saldana, let's say Saldana can even put 9 minutes together where he looks
good.
Hold
on, are you saying Sean Woodson doesn't throw a lot of volume?
No, no, he does, but he doesn't necessarily do it with power throughout the whole entire fight. That's my only concern.
Death by a thousand cuts.
Oh, it's going to hit him. That's, I'm sorry, if that was the point I was getting across, that's not what I'm trying to say at all. Woodson is going to hit you quite a few times. I'm just not sure how he's going to look after that leg's been kicked out, if Saldana can make this competitive early, because I think Saldana is going to look good early on, and I do think he is going to land some of his own power shots, because Woodson does have good footwork, but I'm almost worried that he might move a little bit too much early on, and if Saldana can throw in combinations, maybe he could have some success through that. But I think the overall boxing of Woodson is so crisp that he's going to be able to find a lot of openings in some of those in-betweens, because he is very long for this division. He's good in the clinch. And I do feel like some of the elbows, some of the knees, some of those mid-range weapons that you look for in a long-rangier guy like Sean Woodson are really going to be apparent as this fight continues.
The only thing about Woodson that scares me in this matchup is when distance is established, sometimes he'll rush forward like Dricus du Plessis and he'll throw a lot of shots at once, and he does that from Orthodox. He'll switch stances a fair bit. When he's from Southpaw, he's just looking to kind of keep his right hand out and land the left cross. When he goes over to Orthodox, he's throwing a lot more in terms of 1-2s. And from Woodson, he throws kicks out there, but they're more to establish distance than anything. They're not really, they are prodding shots. They're not more to kind of cause damage like a Jose Aldo leg kick.
More like so, a Tony Ferguson one.
When you look at this one, even in that third round against Arosa for Woodson, he was able to drop him, and then Arosa went, well, we're not playing
Julian's
boxing anymore.
Julian.
We're going to take this one down to the mat where he excels. Success, excels. Throw them together. Success, yeah. Chuck in the house. Matt, when I do look at this fight, Woodson is a pretty darn big favorite. Open minus 300, minus 315. Luis Saldana open plus 250. Still roughly there. So he is a pretty big underdog here. 2-1 in the UFC for him. 3-1 in the UFC for Sean Woodson, who is an underdog against Terrence McKinney. More than a 2-1 underdog in that matchup. We have a look at the topology votes, Matt. Surprise to us, there to you. I would think these are going to be closer than the ones that I put out there. So I'm going to say over under 65% Woodson.
I'll say over.
Think it's going to be over? Oh my God.
I didn't think it'd be that far over.
790 votes, 95% Woodson, 73% by decision, 20% by knockout. For the 5% that have Saldana, 49% by decision, 23% by knockout. I think Luis Saldana has a good shot with his wrestling. I think he's quite active once he gets it to the mat. I don't love his top control. I hate his gas tank. But I think if Saldana can bring it together, he is the more complete fighter in this matchup. But I love the volume out of Woodson. The thing that I don't like out of Luis Saldana, and I haven't talked about it until now, I talked about it early on in the card. There's fighters that have that still brush saw kind of stance. Luis Saldana stands with his hands out and really low. But when he goes to throw, he doesn't throw from an awkward angle. He usually brings his hands up to then strike, and then he brings them back down low. When he has them low and he's backing up, he gets hit clean. He will duck and roll out of some of his shots, which is really cool to see. Even in the third round, he still keeps that cognizance that he can bob and weave out of shots. Sean Woodson does that like the best of them in this division. It's just that Sean Woodson, I love the boxing, and I like that fact that you got a guy with volume and he can throw with some power, death by a thousand paper cuts, against Luis Saldana, who keeps his hands low for the most part. I like Sean Woodson in the matchup. Don't love him at a minus 300, but for the sake of being fight night picks and making a pick, I'll pick Woodson here.
I think this is going to be an incredibly exciting fight. I really do, because I do think Saldana can make Sean Woodson pay in a few areas in this matchup. Because let's say Woodson does get reckless with some of his forward pressure, Saldana can go under, get the takedown, and I really do think Saldana can have some success on the feet. I definitely favor Sean Woodson on the feet in the striking, and that's why I'm going to pick Sean Woodson, but I don't think it's necessarily a wash for Saldana if this is at kickboxing or boxing range, because I do like his ability to put some shots together, and it's not like he has no power whatsoever. So if he is able to land early on Sean Woodson, again, maybe he can close that gap in the gas tanks.
I hate to say this because it seems like I'm kicking a guy when he's down, but this would have been the perfect Dominic Cruz fight, because you look at the underhooks from both guys in the clinch positions and exactly what they can do. You know he would have been excited about this one, but both of us going with the man out of St. Louis, Sean the Sniper Woodson, to get the win. Let us know down below in the comment section if you have Woodson, if you have Saldana, who you have for all of these fights, because we have a stack card, including a main event between welterweight champ Kamaru Usman looking to defend against Leon Edwards. It's a big time card. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
It's the return of the... Oh, wait. No, wait, you're kidding. No, it is. It's Lucia Pudzilova making her return to the UFC. She went on a terrible losing streak, but there was some fight of the nights in there, and she ends up over with Octagon, a tidy little record over there. She was able to go 5-1 at 135 pounds, and the only loss to UFC veteran Talita Bernardo there. Now, all of those fights, all decisions. And for Lucia Pudzilova, she has switched things up. She's gone over to train with Straight Blast Gym Ireland. You don't hear that gym very often. The main gym, she's been training with Richie Smullen. She's been training with Artem Lobov. She's been training with Conor McGregor. So Lucia Pudzilova coming in here looking to set the world on fire, taking on Jackson Winks, Mulan Wu Yanan, a fighter who's 1-4 in her last five fights. Fought in a fight of the night her last time out against Maeda Buena Silva. Almost got finished in the first round. Made it competitive round two. Made it competitive round three. At least the commentary made it seem that way. And for Wu Yanan, she's always bouncing the balls of her feet. Always walking forward. Either giving damage or absorbing damage. And before that fight against Maeda Buena Silva, the big concern was earlier on in the year, she tore her MCL. She still wears a knee brace in training. But she did look very mobile in that fight. Looked like the same person round one to round three. Slowed down a little bit, but that's to be expected. So for Wu Yanan, very much of the ilk that I have a Sanda background. We're talking kickboxing all day. Struggles with the takedowns at times. And if you do look at it for the level of competition for Wu Yanan, somebody who came into the UFC very young, doesn't fight very often. If you look at it, fights in 2017, 18, 19, 21, all just one fight per year. Looking to get back to the regularity that saw her become the WLF Wars champion back when she was much younger. But in 2022, this is her second bout of action. So you do like to see that. But level competition, lose to Gina Mazzani. Beats Lauren Mueller, where she was a big underdog by submission. And at that time, Mueller was undefeated. Lose to Mizuki by split decision. Lose to Jocelyn Edwards. And then loses to Maeda Buena Silva. The level of competition's kind of been all over the place.
It has been.
The other thing for Lucia Pudzilova, switches camps, but I've seen the same fighter since she was in the UFC to the fighter that there is now. Fight of the night against Irene Aldana. The one thing that I absolutely hate, Matt, that nobody's going to talk about, Lucia Pudzilova has exhibition experience since she left the UFC. She fought in an octagon tournament. She lost to 18-year-old Teresa Bleda, who was an amateur, just an amateur at that time. Lost that one by split decision. I thought Pudzilova won the fight 2-1. They were three-minute fights, three-minute rounds. Not good when you're losing to an 18-year-old amateur fight. Now, the fighter that she fought is undefeated now as a pro. She's going to be taking part on Dana White's Contender Series later on this year. She's 5-0 as a pro. Week 7, you can look for that out of Teresa Bleda, whose nickname is Ronda. Ronda Rousey. She goes for a lot of takedowns. I fucking hate that she lost to an 18-year-old amateur fighter when she
got Bo Cruz. Like, she was Tobias Harris who showed up at the court like, yeah, I got this. I was in the UFC. And the next thing you know, you're getting blocked and it's going on social media.
Now, I thought she won the fight, but still, that's bad.
Yeah, not good at all. For Pudzilova, she does crash forward recklessly a lot. Like a lot. And you're right. The gym change hasn't really changed her as a fundamental fighter. She does still crash forward a lot. And it really does come down to how much her opponent respects her power. Because it's a lot of volume, but there's not a lot of bad intentions sent behind it. She's not somebody who can really hurt you with one shot, even two shots or three shots. Like, it's going to take a lot for her to TKO an opponent. So Wu Yanan is happy to just sit in the pocket, kind of accept that early storm, accept some of that volume, and land her own more damaging shots in the in-between. I think she could win this fight, but I could see this fight just being one of those lower level, like Caitlin Chukagi and Jody Escobel type fights where, okay, Pudzilova's landing more arm shots, if you will, but they're not necessarily shots that you would consider all that significant. They might resound in the minds of the judges, but I don't really think they're going to be the most impactful of shots, but they will land, and I think at a certain point, her overwhelming volume is something that does set these two fighters apart.
That's the trouble. I mean, if you look at it for Pudzilova when she's supposed to take on her 18-year-old amateur exhibition fight. She's curling her dog, so that was kind of different. Interesting stuff. Lost that fight. But for Pudzilova, again, 5-1 is the record outside of the UFC. With the UFC, it was 2-5, so that wasn't really the greatest. But when you do look at it for Pudzilova, does like to fight behind the jab and then throw her right hand. She'll throw 1, 2, 3 jabs just to land that right hand.
She didn't get hit a lot.
Moves a lot side to side. The fight against Irene Aldana, that is a split decision loss on her record. The fight that I don't like is the one against Justine Kish where She threw little to no volume in that one. Kish was able to just dart in and out on the outside. Smaller fighter, less in terms of, overall reach.
And that felt like a setup fight for Puzulova at the time. Like, Kish was kind of on her way out. This was a prospect somewhat on the rise.
Kish hadn't fought in a long time.
Exactly. It was a great opportunity for her, really, and she just wasn't able to capitalize.
So, an odd fight this one is, and I mean, if you look at it for Puzulova, you talk about high hopes. When they went to her home country of Czechia, she was in the co-main event against Liz Carmouche and didn't get the win against Carmouche. Bellator champion, Liz Carmouche. Wow. So the odds in this one, Matt, Puzulova open -210, -160 right now. I know it sounds like we're being harsh. We can definitely add to her game and pick apart Wu Yanan, who we haven't really talked much of. Wu Yanan opened a +180, +130 right now. So the odds are settling in, getting closer to par. We have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. One fighter is 1-4 in their last five. One fighter is 4-1 in their last five. Tapology votes probably aren't that close. I'm going to say over under 67.5% Puzulova.
I'll say over.
I'm going to say over. It's way over. 728 total votes. 80% Puzulova. 93% by decision for the 20% that have Wu Yanan. 85% by decision. Wu Yanan of Jackson Wink MMA fame as it stands right now, training with Meng Bo, former ONE Championship great, Holly Holm, Arlene Blenko. Matt, I talk about Arlene every week.
You do.
She's scrappy. So you do look at this one, two bigger gyms going at it. Wu Yanan's been active. This is the first time that she's fought in the UFC twice in 1 year. For Puzulova, looking to keep that role that she's had over with Octagon. The last fight I watched of Puzulova, she did look very good, but I translated the European odds. It was 1.12 to 5.31. That means that she was a -833 favorite, and her opponent was +431, and she looked like a -833 favorite should look. Yeah. She just played around on the outside and looked really good with her striking. So good opportunity for Puzulova. For Wu Yanan, she can kind of get overwhelmed in her fights, even though she does move in and out quite a bit, has good movement. But one power shot and Wu Yanan can kind of, there's like a switch that doesn't go off. So it is a tricky fight if you're trying to make a pick on this one.
Yeah, I have no idea who's going to win this fight. And even if the winner wins in spectacular fashion, I'm still not going to have any idea what to think of these fighters moving forward. And I'm perfectly fine admitting that, because a win in this matchup doesn't really get either fighter anything other than another fight in the organization. I'm going to ever so slightly side with Puzulova, because they would have brought her back for some reason. They must see her as still having some of the potential that she once did, because she was an exciting fighter before she left the UFC. I didn't think she was a great fighter at that time, and her experience away from the UFC still has been somewhat questionable. Like, the fact that the only person that you fought who has any name recognition whatsoever in Talita Bernardo, who's not a world beater by any means, was able to beat her is a little bit concerning, but I'll ever so slightly favor her volume on the outside in this matchup.
You look at Lucia Puzulova, and she does tend to really kind of meet you fire with fire. Keeps landing that jab to set up her right hand. You look at it for her in the UFC. Justine Kitsch getting a takedown. She got one against Antonina Shevchenko herself. Carmouche was able to get it going. Sarah Morris was able to get it going, even though Puzulova dropped her twice in that fight. The thing with Lucia Puzulova, it can be a lot of volume, like the fight against Irene Aldana. It can be a lot of volume, like some of these fights that we've seen over with Octagon. It can be a lot of defending takedowns, but she does struggle against the volume. I like Wu Yanan, what I saw against Maeda Buena Silva. Obviously, she got dropped in the first round, whether they considered a knockdown or not. Did rally in that one. Takes two to tango to get a fight of the night. I like the in and out of Wu Yanan. And what I've seen after that MCL injury that really did scare me going into that matchup. So I'm going to go with Mulan Wu Yanan as the underdog. A pair of unranked women's bantamweights going at it. We're split on the pick. Matt with Puzulova. Me with Yanan. It should be a fun fight that gets us set up for fights like Tyson Pedro and Harry Hunsucker.
Burr, 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 burr.
Hunsucker! Let's get into it, Matt. Big time card. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, let's get into it. Coming up this weekend, if you know anything about Fight Night Picks, my guy, Leonardo Santos, is going to be taking on Jared Flash Gordon. And for my guy, Leonardo Santos, I know the last two fights have probably been the worst two fights of his career. There's glimpses. There's little bits of hope. But for Santos, it's just kind of crazy. I mean, it's been the weirdest run in the UFC. It's been the weirdest career that we've ever seen. I mean, he's kind of like the Nomar Garciaparra. The Andrew Jones, he's a little bit like, I mean...
I think an Adam Dunn. Like, Adam Dunn had more plate appearances and via the three true outcomes, like, than you could. So he had 51% of all of his at-bats and via walk, strikeout, or home run. Fun fact about Adam
Dunn. He's kind of like the Dave Steeb of this division. It's really weird because at the end of the day... Is he a Hall of Famer?
No.
He bridges on it with the resume that he does have. Because if you just take it for part and parcel, he was competing in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu tournaments in the late 90s, early 2000s. They went, hey, Leo, you want to fight the hottest prospect in all of MMA? Here's Takanori Gomi. And then he loses in Chuto, Brazil in 2002. And that's fine, because after he fights there, he ends up fighting over on the Ultimate Fighter, wins the Ultimate Fighter Brazil, beats Thiago Santos Marreta at 170 pounds in that tournament. He goes on a 12-fight unbeaten streak from 2010 to 2021. I mean, he's got wins over who? Adriano Martins, the guy that cold-cocked Islam Makhachev. He beats, who else? Anthony Rocco Martin. He knocks out Kevin Lee. And nobody's ever going to remember that because of his last two fights when he was over 40 years old. He fights Grant Dawson, and he did not look good at all in that fight. He fights a guy in Clay Guida where he drops him and tries to finish him in the first round and then loses all steam by the second round. He is a jiu-jitsu specialist at Nova União, which is full of killers. I mean, Jose Aldo's trained under Nova União for the majority of his career. For Leonardo Santos, I mean, the accreditations, he's a fourth degree Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt, 2002, 2003, 2004, 2005 IBJJF world champion. All of these things that I say, if you just took them for what they're worth, man, this guy's a Hall of Famer, isn't he, Craig? You just wrote the script. Here's induction ceremony. Craig Allen up there. I give the speech, but... Inactivity's plagued his career, doesn't fight very often, and what we've seen in his last three fights, including the Roman Bogatov performance, where Bogatov lost 2 points due to knee strikes, it just didn't look like the old Leo Santos, even though he did look all right against Guida in the first round. Taking on a guy in Jared Gordon, who's also been there, done that, former CFFC champ, featured on Dana White's Looking for a Fight, back when I think Nick the Tooth was still a thing, gets a win over Bill Algeo. Matt, for Jared Gordon, he's had good spots in the UFC, he's had bad spots, he had that three-fight win streak before he faced off against one, Grant Dawson, and got submitted. Both guys probably don't want to hang out with Grant Dawson very much, but for you in this matchup, Matt, it's tough seeing Leo Santos this way.
He has a problem that most 42-year-old athletes would have. He gets tired faster.
Hard time getting it up?
Yeah, pretty much. He just gets tired faster than pretty much everybody else in the division. And his attacks aren't all that sustainable at this point of his career. Yes, he can throw with power. Yes, he can finish you on the mat. But the problem is, fatigue kind of takes away most of your skills. And when he gets tired, he is not the same skilled fighter that he is in the first 3 or 4 minutes of a fight. And the problem was there even when he was younger. It wasn't as accentuated because he was still in his prime, if you will. But at this point of his career, I don't know what he can do other than knock out Jared Gordon very fast like he did against Stevie Ray and hope to get a win in this matchup. Because Jared Gordon, not that he was made in a lab to beat very many fighters, but he is kind of made to beat a fighter like Leonardo Santos. He does wrestle a lot. He does have phenomenal cardio. Not the best finisher on the mat, but he is defensively sound, and he doesn't give you a lot of space either when he does grapple with you. He's not someone who really floats on top and is going to give you a lot of opportunities to pull off a submission off of your back. You normally have to get on top of him and really beat it out of him if that's what you want to get. Hashtag phrasing, but still. For Santos, again, those skills would have been there 5-6 years ago. I just don't necessarily think he's going to be able to carry those skills late into a fight against Jared Gordon. And thinking about this fight, I immediately thought of the Hakran Diaz fight that sort of got Gordon known in the UFC. Diaz was a guy who had a lot of hype, but in the UFC was a little bit past it, so we never really got to see the prime version of him. But Gordon just beat the brakes off him, really. Like, took the fight from him, made his ground and pound really ugly, and Diaz is a guy who honestly fights in a very similar manner to Santos, especially at this stage of their careers. So it's not that Gordon should be a minus 330 favorite against a lot of guys in this division, but at this stage of Santos's career, I can more than easily see a world where Jared Gordon gets two 10-8 rounds and finishes him in the third. But I could see a world where Santos is able to land some power shots early where he still does have a full gas tank, and they could be damaging enough to put Gordon out.
The big thing about Jared Gordon that's always brought up by the broadcast, his grandfather was Sal Ferrello, a boxer who went 38-3-1, so that's always the talking point. Jared Gordon is a formidable boxer guy.
He's kind of slow on the feet.
He switched up camps in the past. He's a Killcliff FC guy now. Still sounds weird when I say it. I don't know about the energy drinks. I did hear Joe Rogan on Theo Von's podcast say, hey, they got my flavor now. It's pineapple jalapeno. And I tell you what, I've had those ginger ales that are spicy. I don't like spicy and sweet. That's not my deal.
Oh, I love it. I'm not going to lie.
I don't like it. But if I do look at it for Jared Gordon, here's some crazy things. 6-4 in the UFC. Fourth all-time in lightweight history with significant strike accuracy at 56.4%. Number one is Gaethje. He's 10th all-time at strikes landed per minute, 5.42. He's 10th all-time in the lightweight division strike differential at 1.54. He can defend takedowns. He can go for takedowns. He can strike on the feet. He can match you a little bit with your striking. Santos obviously has an advantage in terms of height and reach over most guys in the lightweight division. It's just, how sustainable are things for Santos at this point?
Like, he must cut an incredible amount of weight to get down to 155, and that could not be easy on his body at 42 and a half years of age.
And I've seen Gordon go out there and go back and forth, tit for tat, against a bigger, longer type of guy in Bill Algeo, who is 6 feet tall and has a 73-inch reach, and he was able to get the win over him to win that CFFC belt by grinding on him. That was how Gordon was able to get it done. And Gordon's fought wrestlers in the past and guys that are good. I mean, Chris Fishgold's an accredited Polaris grappler. Jared Gordon was able to take things down to the mat, rinse and repeat with his takedowns, ground things out. So we'll see how it plays out this weekend. Gordon, as was mentioned, is a pretty big favorite. Open minus 225, minus 330 right now for Leo Santos. Open plus 190, plus 255. And if we have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt, I don't anticipate they're going to be very close. I'm going to say over under 85% Gordon.
I think they'll be under, honestly.
I think they're going to be under. They're slightly over. 758 total votes, 87% Gordon, 83% by decision for the 13% that have Santos. It's like a lifesaver pack. 35% decision, 30% submission, 29% by knockout. Those numbers don't add up. But in this matchup here, Matt, I think Jared Gordon can have success keeping things on the feet and landing some volume.
I do worry about him on the feet, if I'm being completely honest. Like, Jared Gordon's been hurt and finished in a number of fights.
Oh, all of his losses, all five of them, are by finish.
So I don't necessarily think standing on the feet with a guy who has an obvious power advantage over him is necessarily the best idea. I think he is defensively sound enough on the mat to avoid some of those big explosions from Santos. I think the clinch up against the cage is going to be a big tool for Gordon to really wear on Santos, try to diminish that power bar of him, especially earlier on in this fight. And then maybe he will be able to even go for a finish in the second, third round, because if Gordon can get some of that ground and pound going, it is exhausting for the bottom fighter to be on the receiving end of that. And I think Gordon can have a lot of success. I'm just gonna end it with this. Why the hell did Jared Gordon ever fight Charles Oliveira when Charles Oliveira had won like six in a row? That might be the worst fight that the matchmakers have ever put together, and it makes me question just everything about some of this sport sometimes.
Hey, Jared, you want a shot at the title? You gotta go through Charles first. Sign me up, coach. Yeah, Gordon wasn't able to get it done. The fight for me, the Santos fight against Bogatov, where he was just held up against the cage for large portions of that fight, gives me a little bit of pause. The Grant Dawson lasting hammer fist to Leo Santos out. And then he looked great against Guida, and then in the second round didn't have enough left in the tank. I don't know how the referee didn't end that fight, if we're all being honest with each other, because Santos just continued to hammer
away. You could have said that about Nate Landwehr last night. That one, look at him. He ended up winning the fight.
Wild fight. So both of us going with Flash Gordon in this fight to get the win. It breaks my soul to not talk about Leo Santos in the winner's column here. But we have an interesting fight nonetheless. A main card that includes Hunsucker and Pedro and Aldo and Dwalishvili. So it should be a lot of fun. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Coming up this week, which will be a portion of the Fight Night Picks Sidekick Live for the main card, we have Kentucky's own The Hurricane, Harry Hunsucker, looking to make Tyson Pedro Hunsuck it. And for Tyson Pedro, came back after forever away to get a first-round finish over Ike Villanueva, where the leg kicks really were the story of the fight. And once he was able to drop Ike at the end of the first round, a couple of uppercuts down on the mat, really able to finish it off. And for Tyson Pedro, this is a guy that UFC fans have known and loved since he made his debut years ago. And for Pedro, black belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, black belt in Japanese Jiu-Jitsu, and he does have a black belt in karate as well. And when you watch Pedro, I mean, very, very fun and intriguing fighter. He dropped Ovince St. Preux only to get straight arm locked in that fight. Really weird. You look at it, there were obviously some stumbling blocks. He tried to make a good account of himself against Shogun Hua until late career stage Shogun was able
good
to
early, though.
Show his veteran guile and hurt Pedro's knee. And from that knee on, That's where the career really did get derailed. And if you look at it for Pedro, his brother-in-law is tied to Ivasa, a guy who's been close to the camp throughout. But you look at Pedro ahead of his fight against Ike Villanueva, switched it up at City Kickboxing. You had Carlos Ahlberg there, Eugene Behrman, looked really good. Sticking with the sauce for this matchup against Terry Hunsucker, who's throwing it out on Instagram. He's the most doubted UFC fighter out there, and I get it. He is 7-5. You look at it on Dana White's Contender Series. Looked great against Jared Vandera. Until he didn't. He makes a short notice UFC debut on just days notice against Tai Tuivasa. Isn't able to get the win there. Takes on a guy in Justin Taffa where Taffa, like, they're going for grappling exchange. Taffa ends up on top and then they get back to standing and Taffa finishes it. How weird is it though? You talk about UFC matchmaking. Why throw Harry Hunsucker in there against another Australian?
That is weird. Just why are you putting him in this position to begin with? I understand for Tyson Pedro, we're still trying to gauge where he is in this division. But you go from beating Ike Villanueva, who, okay, it means that you still belong in the sport and in this organization. You would think he would get a significant jump up in competition after that to see, okay, what percentage of the old Tyson Pedro are you still? And I just don't really feel like he's necessarily getting that jump in competition against Harry Hunsucker.
But Matt, how many fights at light heavyweight has Harry Hunsucker had in his pro career?
Didn't he have like two early or
no? He had none.
Exactly. So now you're making a guy who has had a bit of a saltier record in the division and just throughout his career cut a massive amount of weight to not fight a small guy at light heavyweight. And that has to be said too. Like Tyson Pedro is as big of a fighter as you can get for this division. Like he would look very similar to Jamal Hill. They stack up very similarly to each other. So I do feel like Tyson Pedro, he definitely has the grappling advantage in this matchup. We've seen him offensively have really nice submissions. I always go back to the Saberbeck Safarov fight where he just grabs his arm and wrenches it backwards. It was a really, really nice performance from him. And I know Saperbeg's not necessarily the cleanest guy you've ever seen in the UFC, but still.
What do you mean? He doesn't wash well?
You get what I mean. He's not the cleanest technically in the UFC, but Tyson Pedro has shown glimpses of being a very promising prospect. And I know injuries have somewhat derailed that hype train from where it once was. He was a favorite against Alir Latifi at one point, which is like kind of wild to think about in hindsight, because Alir then went on to beat Ovin St. Preux and have like sort of his mini little run there. So Tyson Pedro at one point was thought of as sort of an Ankalaev type or a Jamal Hill guy. Like he's going to go on to main event fight nights. He's going to go on to beat some of these legends. But after that Shogun loss and the knee injury, it really is hard to figure out what is Tyson Pedro's overall ceiling. Now, I do expect him to be the much longer range striker in this fight, and I know that's weird to say, because like you said, Hunsucker is a heavyweight moving down to light heavyweight, but Tyson Pedro throws kicks like an MFer, and not just to the head, not just to the body, but to the legs too, and this isn't a new part of his game. He even used those same kicks against Shogun in the first round of their fight. He hurt Shogun with a front kick up the middle, and kicks have always been a really unique part of Tyson Pedro's game, because he is so long and rangy. I will say this though, I vividly remember Tyson Pedro's UFC debut against Khalil Roundtree. Khalil Roundtree hit him one time and put him on the ground with a straight right, and Tyson Pedro has shown the inability to sort of cover up defensively. When it rains, it pours with his striking defense, so let's say Hunsucker can have some success early. Maybe he could start rolling downhill a la Giannis in the transition and have some success. I just think he's going to run into a lot of issues if he does start to charge forward. That's when the grappling of Pedro can start to take over. And I think that's an area where he has an overwhelming advantage in.
Harry Hunsucker's 0-3 when Dana White's in the building. Contender Series and two fights in the UFC. He's 0-2 in the UFC against Australians. This is his second Australian. Tyson Pedro, I talked about it earlier on this card with a couple of different fighters. His striking defense is hands right here. The Steel Brush Saw. I'm going to keep talking about it until they sponsor the show. Oh, wait, Simon Steel. He keeps his hands incredibly low, and then he waits for his opponent to come in. He can counter. He can push offensively, throw. He does punch from weird angles. We talked about some of these guys where, like,
Luis, the kicks are good.
Luis Saldana keeps his hands low, but then he eats a lot of shots for his troubles. The thing about Harry Hunsucker, all of his fights have gone to a finish. There's been no decisions as a pro. For Hunsucker, the great thing that he can do is duck down for a level change, because five of his wins are by submission. Normally he clubs you down and then subs you like Gerald Meerschaert.
Club and sub.
But he can duck levels, come up over with the overhand right, and that's a spot where Pedro struggles because his hands are already low, susceptible to a takedown like in the Latifi fight. Hunsucker comes over the top, gets a finish win, and everybody that doubted Harry Hunsucker looks like a silly goose to that point. So again, Hunsucker's to the point where, just like Billy Talent, like, nothing to lose. And he gets a big opportunity on this pay-per-view main card to get a win over Pedro, who's an inflated favorite. He opened a minus 750. He's a minus 800. I'm not adding this a leg to anything. I'm just going to watch it on the sidekick. Hunsucker opened plus 550. They say plus 530 or thereabouts. So Hunsucker, big underdog. Pedro, big favorite. We saw it against Ike Villanueva, Hurricane Ike. Seems like just a... That's just a tricky nickname there. Now, from Hurricane Ike to Hurricane Hunsucker. Good opportunity for him there. We have a look at the topology votes, Matt. Surprise to us, there to you. I'm going to say over under 95% Pedro.
I'll say under just because that's a wild percentage, but it's still over.
815 total votes. 97% Pedro, 84% by knockout for the 3% that have Hunsucker, 58-odd% by knockout. Matt, I think we're going to get a finish in this fight. I think that's better than minus 800 Pedro, so maybe go with that one. I'm eager to see what Hunsucker looks like at 205. From his Instagram, he does look really good, so I'm eager to see where he weighs in at. I think he's got a good opportunity here to get a win over a giant name, especially on a main card, but kind of like Zach Borrego on Dana White's Contender Series last week. I think Bo Nickel came through. Pedro's going to come through in the spot, too.
Yeah, I think Tyson Pedro's the much more technical guy in this matchup, so it is hard to pick against him. And let's say things do hit the mat for any period of time. Tyson Pedro does have a very nice submission repertoire that I could see finishing Harry Hunsucker at some point throughout this matchup. So I do like Tyson Pedro, but it should be a fun fight.
Both of us going with Tyson Pedro in the matchup this week. He's way too big of a favorite. Maybe avoid that one. It's just a pick on Fight Night Picks. We have a big-time main card coming up, including Alexander Romanov versus Marcin Tybura, Jose Aldo, Mirab Dolashvili, co-main event, Luke Rockhold versus Paulo Costa, and in the main, Kamaru Usman's taking on Leon Edwards for a second time. Can't wait for it. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Eastern European heavyweight grapplers face off on the main card of UFC 278. We have the former M1 Global heavyweight champ. He's a 15-fight UFC veteran. It's Marcin Tybura taking on King Kong, now you're gone. It's Alexander Romanov. He's undefeated as a pro. And he had one chintzy little fight against former Ultimate Fighter winner Juan Espino, which went his way by way of technical decision because you can't knee a guy to the gonads. And Juan found that one out the hard way. Split technical decision by way of Alexander Romanov. He was a minus 2,200 favorite in his last fight against a short-notice Chase Sherman, who had just been cut from the organization. But Alexander Romanov went in, took him down, grabbed his arm, yanked on it, and Chase went tappity-tap, tap, tap. So for Alexander Romanov, I said this from the start of the show. If you don't watch the intro, you miss out on the good parts. If you're a bantamweight or a flyweight looking to get a sweat on a Tiger Muay Thai in a cardio kickboxing class, and you see Alexander Romanov has been training out of Tiger Muay Thai here recently, do you turn and walk the other way?
I wouldn't mess with him.
No?
No, not
you sure? You wouldn't mess
a
with
a terrifying man.
Well, for Alexander Romanov, a guy who has a sumo background, in 2016, he was a silver medalist at the Open European Championships. Romanov is a different guy. He's a different cat. The level of competition that he faced coming into the UFC wasn't all that great, but you got to see glimpses of a guy who wings punches from weird angles as a southpaw. He was willing to throw a lot more kicks when he was fighting before he came into the UFC. But in the UFC, he's really gone to where his bread is buttered, and he's gone for the takedowns over and over and over again. And for Romanov, obviously, again, 16-0 is the record. 5 UFC fights, 16 takedowns. He's 4th all-time in UFC history of control time at 70.7% of his fights. Top percentage time, 6th all-time ever, any division. 53.4% takedown accuracy, 8th all time at 69.6%. But that weird southpaw kind of thing that he has going for him really does kind of trip up a lot of his opponents. And the only resistance we've seen is in that fight against Juan Espino, where Romanov looked pretty good in the first round. The Senegalese wrestler out of the Canary Islands in Spain looked good in the second round. And then in the third round, Espino looked pretty good there too. Technical decision, Romanov ends up getting the win. But other than that, he's looked great. For Tybura, 9-6 in the UFC, had a 5-fight win streak with 2 performance of the night bonuses against Greg Hardy and Walt Harris going into his fight against Alexander Volkov. And in that fight, both guys looked like they had nothing in the tank the whole time, and it was not fun to watch on the rewatch for this one.
This is a really weird comp to make, but it sort of came to me in the moment. Marcin Tybura reminds me of the evolution of Shaquille O'Neal from the Orlando Magic to the LA Lakers, and please let me explain why. He was an equally dominant player, for instance, between those 2 different tenures, but what was the difference? He slowed down over time and found a way to make the slowness work for him.
Shaquille O'Neal's one of the top 3 players in NBA history. Marcin
Tybura
is 9-6 in the UFC.
How about you listen to the words I say and not just the player that I'm comparing him to? Shaq was very mobile and very fast early on in his career, and I gotta be honest, Marcin Dabor's striking at an earlier stage of his career was a lot faster and a lot more explosive at a certain point. He was a fighter who could throw head kicks from different angles, he had a lot more in terms of longer range techniques, whereas at this point of his career, it does feel like he has slowed down and regressed somewhat in his striking. Now, he has been able to make sort of his plodding forward style work in different ways. He can still have success in this division, but there was once a time where Marcin Dabora almost hit Fabricio Werdum with a left high kick in the fifth round of a main event. Like, that does show a high level of striking for a guy who has seemed a lot flat-footed as of late. So that's where the comparison comes into. He can still be successful, but he doesn't necessarily look like the same fighter he once was. To put it into, like, fighting terms, Derek Brunson kind of had a similar technique turn, where Derek Brunson went from being like, hey, you don't want to strike with this guy at all on the feet. And now he's still dangerous, don't get me wrong, but now there's other guys out there who can definitely outstrike Derek Brunson. You're not really as confident with him as a striker, but he's found other ways to make his game work. Now he relies a little bit more on his wrestling. His cardio's a little bit iffy, and that's what you worry about, but still, these are fighters who were once something and fought in a certain way, who now still maintain the same similarities as that fighter, but they have had to find ways to make their strengths just work in separate ways. I think Tabor is going to have to use his clinch a lot in this fight, which is weird to say because Romanov is so strong in that position, but I do think the size of Tabor is going to come into play at some point. Romanov isn't the same guy he was when he first came into the UFC. I don't know how he made 265. He was built like a big Brock Lesnar type at some point, like not muscle bound, but just a guy that you almost couldn't believe weighed in at 265. He was that big. He is a lot smaller now in this division, and you can look at that in two different ways. Maybe that helps his cardio. Maybe that helps his pressure and his pace, but on the flip side, maybe he is going to struggle a little bit more with some of these bigger, stronger grapplers in the division, but I am really happy that we've seen this step up in competition from Romanov. I think it was really needed in his career, and I think Marcin Dabor is a great guy for him to fight.
Well, in Romanov's fight against Jared Vander, where Romanov was a big favorite, not to the minus 2200 when he fought Chase Sherman, Romanov, between round one and round two, looked pretty damn tired, and then he went right back out there, earned the takedown, he's able to get the finish, and for Marcin Tybura, he tried to initiate that clinch, really long, kind of tiring game plan or of attack against Alexander Volkov. He went 0-16 on takedown attempts, wasn't able to get it to the mat against thick Volkov.
And didn't have an answer for the in-betweens, which was something he was good at. And that's why I bring up the comp. Like, Tabora at one point, I'm not joking, was like a good kickboxer in the UFC. Maybe good is a bit of a stretch, but like he had pops on his shots. He had good footwork. There was a bounce to him. And that just seems to be totally eliminated.
And he does train out of Ankos MMA, which is a very, very good gym. You've had a lot of prospects come out of that gym, but for Marcin Tybura, the big thing is, if somebody goes to take him down, he can rest on his laurels. Well, he shouldn't in this fight, but I have 82% takedown defense, the best in UFC heavyweight history. I have 3 hours, 5 minutes, and 18 seconds of cage time in the UFC, ninth most in heavyweight history, more than Alistair Overeem. For Marcin Tybura inside of a UFC cage.
He got him done fit quick, though.
Wild stuff there. But when it does come down to this matchup for Romanov, it's the bigger movements. For Marcin Tybura, we do know that he has good cardio, even at 36 years of age, almost 37. It's been a hallmark of his game.
This is a uniquely bad matchup for Romanov, though. Like, I know his success is going to come from the areas that probably Tybura is going to invite. Like, he's going to have to clinch at some point. He's probably going to have to grapple himself. But I do think that if Romanov can't get the first takedown, well, he probably won't get the second. He probably won't get the third. I really do think he's going to have to rely on a lot of early success to just stifle the forward movement of Tybura.
And Tybura is the type of weird heavyweight where he can kind of just get up and earn that sweep off the bottom. So good opportunity for Tybura in this matchup. The odds, Tybura open a plus 205, plus 267 or thereabouts. For Romanov, open minus 240, minus 343. His cardio always scares me. I've been a big Romanov guy in the past, or at least a watcher from afar. We have a look at the Tapology vote. Surprise to us, they are to you. Man, the fans don't like Marcin Tybura, and they like Alexander Romanov. I'm going to say over under 90% Romanov.
I'll say over.
Tapology fans are weird. 842 votes, 81% Romanov, 20% by decision, 39% by submission, 34% by knockout. For the 19% that I have Tybura, 74% by decision. I've never seen a more meathead choke since Frank Mir toe-holded Tank Abbott after he didn't want to fight no pretty boy. Like, that was the most meathead thing I've ever seen. Until Alexander Romanov went, you know what? Forearm choke against Rogerio de Lima.
It's kind of gangster, though.
And it worked. Matt, this matchup, we talked about it a lot. Obviously, Tybura has the in-cage experience against some very, very good fighters in the UFC. He has a winning record in the UFC. He's not one of the all-timers, but he is on some all-time lists in terms of just stats on a page.
He's somebody's favorite fighter.
Some weird old gal in Poland.
Yeah, like, but that's the thing. Like, he might not be someone who's remembered throughout history all the time, but, like, there's people out there who really
there
like Marcin Tybura
fights. My hero! Yeah. Watch Tybura roll!
Pretty much. Now, like, he was an entertaining guy. He's been around for a long time. I do think he is a uniquely poor matchup for Romanov, but I said the same thing about Jordan Leavitt before he fought Paddy Pimblett. Paddy Pimblett pretty much ran him over by the time the fight was all said and done, so I do still like Alexander Romanov in this matchup, because again, Tabora's not really going to make him work for the areas that Romanov can have success in. Romanov does have to work to get into the clinch against a lot of guys, whereas Tabora, I think, will welcome that position, and I don't favor anybody in those sort of over-under positions in the division over Romanov, so I'm still going to pick King Kong, but I think this is a very fun fight.
I was kind of hoping in the Yes Theory video where they travel to Moldova that they'd end up meeting, like, Alexander Romanov or Sergei Spivak.
In the woods wrestling a bear?
But instead, they found an old guy with a cast, and they took him to the beach. So it was still fun, but when I look at this matchup, Alexander Romanov with those power takedowns, with Tiger Muay Thai in his back pocket, I'm eager to see what he does with the striking, because think about it, higher weight classes, Nikita Krylov used to train out of Tiger Muay Thai, and he's a pretty damn fun fighter, so I'm eager to see what I get out of Romanov. This is the toughest test to date in the UFC, and I hope that we get a King Kong win out of this one. That's my pick on this one, going with Moldova's King Kong Romanov to get the win. We're in agreement on the pick. Let us know down below in the comment section if you have Tybura to get the win, if you have Romanov, if you're along for the main card and the Fight Night Picks sidekick on Saturday night. We have some big time fights. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Coming up this weekend, the former featherweight king, the king of Rio, Jose Aldo, looks to take on a surging, come on, Marab! Marab Duashvili, the machine, Bert Kreischer's favorite fighter. This should be an interesting fight, Matt, and I absolutely love it because for Marab Duashvili, 63 takedowns landed in the UFC, 50 in the bantamweight division. That's an all-time bantamweight record. How wild is that? A division that Henan Barao dominated for
not
the longest time.
Wrestler,
Dominic Cruz was the GOAT there for the longest time. Rob Duashvili getting things done with his takedowns. He loses his first two fights in the UFC, one by split decision to Frankie Saenz, who probably is watching this fight from like an armchair going, boys, I bet you if I laced him up one more time, I could fight Jose Aldo. And he lost on an odd submission to Ricky Simon, a guy who is up there in terms of takedowns landed in the UFC, a guy who looked great against Jack Shores last time out. For Marab, he's won 7 fights since then, and he got his first finish inside of the UFC against Marlon Moraes, whose left hook Larry landed just about every single time in the first round of their matchup, dropped Marab, ended up on top, hammered away. But by the end of that first round, Marab was hammer-fisting away to poor old Marlon's face, and at the start of the second round, it was more of the same. Marab looked great in his last fight, and he's looked very, very good in these 7 fights, and I think his best fight might have even been the Cody Stamann fight, where he completely blew the doors off of a great, great wrestler. 2019 Sambo, what was he, silver medalist? At the 68kg mark, Marab is still of that ilk, still lacing him up, still getting it done with Sambo, with his grappling. He is not just a one-dimensional guy, because he will throw those looping shots, he will throw a little bit of a jab, and he loves to go full helicopter on spin attacks like he did against Ralphian Stotts to earn the Ring of Combat bantamweight belt.
And pretty great win in hindsight.
If you know anything about Ralphian, he's that hottest prospect or champion at this point over with Bellator. Marab has a great opportunity to face off against a legend like Jose Aldo, who for a time looked like all was lost. Now he's on a tidy little 3-fight win streak. The last 2 fights, he's looked absolutely amazing. And while Rob Font in their last fight outlanded him in terms of significant strikes, in terms of total strikes, Jose Aldo had something that figures more into the overall scoring criteria. 2 judges had it 50-45. Aldo, one had it 49-46. He was like Darren Elkins. He put the damage on him. And it really was the damage against Rob Font that won Jose Aldo that fight.
He lit him up in that fight, and he looked good from round one to round five, which has always been a question mark for Aldo, really throughout his career. Even when he was the GOAT at 145, he would get tired as fights went on. And then Darren at 135 pounds, he didn't really know how his body was going to react, but I really liked the pace that he was able to push in that matchup. But we have seen Jose Aldo do something in two fights down at this weight class later on into fights. He did it against Marlon Vera, where he won that fight, wrestled near the end of that, and he did the same thing against Rob Font in their matchup later on in that fight. So I'm curious to see if he does fight Merab Dvalishvili, and if he does start to feel the effects of the wrestling, would Jose Aldo consider taking a guy like Merab down? Because I think that's where he could get into some trouble in this matchup. If he does try to invite the grappling whatsoever with Dvalishvili, it's going to just completely get rid of the one weapon that he will be able to beat Merab with, and that's his striking. Jose Aldo at 135 is one of those heavy-handed strikers in the division. He might not always get the knockout, but he can get multiple knockdowns. And against Merab, who definitely struggled against the power of Marlon Moraes in their last fight, like, he looked like he was completely out. He was off, or completely out of it, on his feet, stumbling all over the place. Now, he is in phenomenal shape, has great cardio, and those two things do help you recover from really scary situations like that. But if Jose Aldo is able to land the similar shots that Marlon was able to, I think Jose Aldo has a much more sustainable game plan than Marlon does, and I think he has a lot better takedown defense. The difference is, Jose Aldo at this stage of his career, you're still kind of wondering, okay, when is he going to fall off a peak? He might not necessarily be prime Jose Aldo anymore. I don't think I'd get much of an argument if I said that, but he is still a very good version of himself. He kind of went from MVP caliber to all NBA. Like, he still stands out amongst all-stars and amongst ranked fighters. But at a certain point, we are going to see Jose Aldo's cardio fall off a cliff. We are going to see some of that power get diminished. And I'm worried that against a guy like Merab, who can force his cardio on you, he makes it more of a cardio contest than a mixed martial arts fight. Is that going to just sort of wear on Jose Aldo enough and create enough non-separation between these two guys to where Aldo won't be able to land any of his own power shots? But he does have some of the best takedown defense we've ever seen in the UFC. Like, I always go back to Chad Mendes and his prime, where he'd get, like, completely in on the hips of Jose Aldo, and Aldo would be able to scramble, sprawl, do whatever he could to break the grips of any of his opponents. So this fight's going to be amazing no matter who wins.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at it for Jose Aldo, 90% takedown defense, UFC, WEC.
And against good wrestlers, too.
Very good wrestlers. And for Aldo, you've seen a little bit of a progression in his game where he's moved over to boxing much more in his fights, gotten away from the leg kick a little bit. And in the Ricardo Lamas fight, I go back, he had 20 leg kicks in that fight. All 20 counted. They really did. And if you look at it for Jose Aldo, you look at it, the fight against Marlon Vera, 6. They were early, they counted, and then they opened up his boxing. Against Pedro Munhoz, he landed 8. Now, Pedro landed a ton of them, but that's the biggest part of his game.
He landed a lot on Piotr Jan, even though he lost that fight.
And against Rob Font, he was able to land 10, but it really did open up his boxing, open up his good right hand, his quick left hook, and that's the best part about Jose Aldo. Once he starts getting you up top, that gets him into an opportunity where he can rip to the body, really slow those energy systems, and from there, it's just that snowball effect of Aldo's game. From Rob, herky-jerky striking, back and forth, eats a ton of leg kicks. He even did in his fight against Marlon Moraes. But he just goes back to the wall with his takedowns. And even if you pop back up, you pop up, he still has his hands locked around the seatbelt position. And then he gets you back down to the mat. So very, very fun right there out of both these guys. Very much clash of styles. Will Jose Aldo be able to keep up his pace? Because there were always questions. I mean, from 2015 to the summer of 2020, he went 3-6. And then since then, he rips off these three
best fighters in the
wins.
World, though.
He did. I mean, Max Holloway a couple times. Conor McGregor, obviously, had the fight against Piotr Jan.
Volkanovski.
Alexander Volkanovski, the split decision loss to Marlon Moraes, which up in the air, who won, who didn't. Both of these guys, opposite ends of the spectrum. MMA Mass says Merab wins. And somebody threw it in the comment section this week. Craig, you should do MMA math more often. You were right when you did it for Nate Landwehr against David Onama. You should do it. No, that's not how this works. Even though you have a bad week, you dance with the girl that you brought. You keep doing what you were doing. When you look at this fight, Matt, Jose Aldo open a minus 170 favorite, minus 103 right now. For Merab, open the underdog, plus 145, minus 120. And if we have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt, surprise us there to you. Honestly, I don't know where they're going to be at all. I'm going to say over under 60% Merab.
I'll say under.
I'm going to say under. Yeah, so 881 total votes, 72% Jose Aldo, 74% by decision, 21% by knockout. For the 28% that have Merab to win, 85% by decision, 8% by knockout. So Matt, The odds have shifted towards Merab. The fans have Jose Aldo to get the win. That's always a fun wrinkle in this one. You think Merab's going to be able to just put a pace on him for three rounds? Because it is only a three-round fight. You think he's going to be able to outpace him and just grind out a decision?
It doesn't happen often, and I can't think of many examples, but it has happened a rare few occasions where you have a sweep in a playoff series, but it's a close sweep. Like, the team loses 2 points, and that'll just be it. Like, the margin of victory is like 1.5 points. All the games were close, even though the person got swept. I think that's how this fight's going to go. You can make an argument for either guy absolutely mollywhopping the other in the first round, and it not be competitive whatsoever, but the fact that you can make such a strong argument for both guys is what makes this fight so much fun. I'm ever so slightly going to pick Merab Dvalishvili, even though I can fully admit that things can go very poorly for him 5 seconds into this matchup. The difference is, Merab has shown the ability to fight through some very poor instances. Even his loss to Ricky Simone, he got choked out in the strangest way possible. It was like he saw a ghost.
Keep kicking. Keep kicking.
Was he out? I'm not a doctor. Maybe he was. I don't know. It was really weird, though. But Merab, he got that dog in him. And if things do go poorly for him in the first 5 seconds, I think he can fight through some of those areas. Whereas with Jose Aldo, I think he's going to need that early success to really win this fight, because Merab Dvalishvili's wrestling does feel inevitable for a lot of guys at this division. And I know Aldo has some all-time great takedown defense, but Merab Dvalishvili has some all-time great takedown offense. So that's why I think this fight's going to be so much fun. You sort of have two greats in their own areas going to battle and going to show who's better in that one situation. So I like Merab Dvalishvili, but I am very open to a world where Jose Aldo looks phenomenal.
Merab lands 7.3 takedowns per 15 minutes. It's insane. Most takedowns in UFC bantamweight history for Merab. Jose Aldo has a really great left hand, really good boxing, really good takedown defense. I think he knocks Merab out in the first round. I mean, this feels to me like one of those fights where I went with Jack Hermanson and it was totally against all of the fans that were out there and it felt really silly, and he was able to outpoint in that matchup. For me, I look at this fight as Merab has great takedowns. He has wonky striking that opens up some of his takedowns, but once he gets one, he stops striking, and then it's just all takedowns, and I'm eager to see what we get out of Merab when and if Jose Aldo is able to defend some takedowns. I love Jose Aldo's striking. I think he can get it done here against Merab. Merab's one of those tricky guys, though. You can still kick his lead leg as hard as you want. Kick it like a mule if you want. And
he'll
continues
fall down
to go
and turn
forward.
It into a wrestling exchange. Yeah. That's why I like Merab in this. Again, Jose Aldo, I think, can have a really good first 7 minutes, but then I worry about him after that. Whereas Merab, I kind of worry about him for the first 7 minutes, and then I become more confident in him. I think you can make a very strong case for either one of these guys fighting. That's why the odds are so close, and that's why this could quite possibly even be a title eliminator. Like, I know the bantamweight division has a lot of very exciting names, a lot of very popular names, and they can make a lot of exciting fights in the future. And the good thing is, a lot of these guys are matched up right now, so we are going to get some sort of closure to this division and the title picture sooner rather than later, but I'm really excited for this fight. I think it's going to be an incredible one.
The winner fights Marlon Vera. Matt has Merab to get the win. I'm going with the King of Rio, Jose Aldo, to get it done. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have. It's going to be a contentious fight. There's going to be plenty of comments of flying, so make sure you get yours down there. We have a big time co-main event between the Eraser, Paulo Costa, and Luke Rockhold. Male model. And in the main event, Kamaru Usman taking on Leon Edwards, the rematch. So you're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Co-main event of UFC 278. We have Borachinha. We have the Eraser. It's Paulo Costa looking to get his first win in about 3 years when he takes on Luke Rockhold, the former middleweight champ in the UFC and Strikeforce, looking to get his first win in almost 5 years. He got the big time finish win over the former World Series double champ David Branch. He looked amazing, looked like the old Luke Rockhold. And then he took on two really tough fighters and lost in two really tough ways. And for Luke Rockhold, left hook Larry, it's a meme, it's out there, it is what it is. But for Rockhold, he struggles with left-handed attacks on the pullback like he does with figuring out what to do with his hands in the crowd at UFC events.
You know what I'm going to say? Luke Rockhold might be Fat Joe's favorite fighter because he hits him with the lean back.
He loves
lean
it.
Lean back.
If you do look at it, I mean, for Paulo Costa's last time out, he tried to do the Nick Diaz, fooled ya. We're just going to fight at 205. Let's just do it. Took on Marvin Vettori. You can make a case for the first round. He won the second round, but there was an eye poke where he lost a point. And in the fifth round, he started to pour it on Marvin Vettori. So an interesting look for Paulo Costa. His last bit of action against Vettori was about 9.5 months ago. Before that, almost 2 years ago, against Israel Adesanya, where it looked like Paulo had no answers. Now, did he get into the wine a little bit too much before the fight?
That was the story.
Allegedly. But for Paulo, physically looks pretty damn good on his Instagram. And I'm sure they're not going to show you bad pictures, but
it's a cold day in hell when Paulo Costa looks bad, I'd say, on Instagram.
He looked pretty good over there. He looks like he's got a champ camp built around him, like five guys massaging his shoulders. He looks like Ramses on Nacho Libre. Like, Ramses' legs is the best. His arms are the best. That was such a good movie. But if you look at it for Paulo Costa, it's all built around him for the eraser. It's weird, right? Because, I mean, for Luke Rockhold, he was doing the damn thing in the mid-2000s. For Paulo Costa, 2017 was his year. I mean, the win over McClellan of EFC fame, the win over Oluwole Bamboche, the win over Johnny Hendricks capping it off at UFC 217, where Michael Bisping was losing his middleweight title to George St. Pierre on the same card. An interesting run for Paulo Costa, the win over Uriah Hall, the win over Yoel Romero. And people will tell you, well, Paulo Costa beat Yoel Romero. Yoel Romero knocked out Luke Rockhold and kissed him on the west side of Australia like it was a movie. So Paulo Costa is going to win. I'm here to tell you, I don't know why Luke Rockhold's in this matchup, simply because of the injuries. I mean, obviously the knockout woes.
The brittle chin and the poor striking defense.
The long time away, the shin injury that, you know, he had to keep covered up by like a Teflon sleeve when he fought Jan Blachowicz only to get knocked out. Like he got knocked out, like he went down
three more times,
and then the referee's trying to go in, and Jan's like
feeding it to
hold me back, ref, and he's feeding him the right, just boom, boom, boom. So it is an odd matchup for me, because for Costa, while he didn't beat Vettori at 205, I thought he still looked serviceable, and for Luke Rockhold, I haven't seen that guy in almost 5 years.
I'm worried about the weight cut for both guys to 185. If I'm being completely honest, like you said, Costa kind of pulled a trap card, and he was like, hey. If we're fighting a light heavyweight, that'd be a lot cooler. And everyone, Dana White included, was like, sure, we'll let you. Who cares? And good on Marvin Vettori for taking the fight. Like, he is a bad MF-er for doing that. And he was able to win, so good for Vettori. But still, Paulo Costa showed a very good gas tank in that fight. And that's something I've been saying his whole entire career. Paulo Costa doesn't have a cardio issue. He might have a pacing issue sometimes, but that's very different than a guy who can't fight at a high pace for extended periods of time. If you go back to the Yoel Romero fight, that's one of the craziest fights of all time, where he hurts Romero early. Romero hurts him back early in the first round, and then Costa marches him forward for the next 10 minutes. And I know we get tired in the last 3-4 minutes of that fight, but anybody on the face of the earth would have got tired under a pace like that against a guy like Yoel Romero. But what I do like out of Costa is that he can land power shots from the first minute of a fight, even into the 25th minute of a fight, to give him that luxury against Marvin Vettori. They might not necessarily be knockout strikes, but listen, Marvin Vettori has a much better chin than Luke Rockhold ever has. And the thing about Rockhold is that he's good enough in the stand-up to think he is a stand-up fighter, but it completely ignores the best part of his game, which is his offensive grappling. And even his defensive grappling off his back is absurd. He can hit you with sweeps, he has triangle chokes, he has arm bars. This is one of the better pure grapplers in the division, but it feels like he almost forgets that in some of his fights and relies on his striking to hurt his opponent, and then he can start to go after some of the grappling exchanges like he did against Michael Bisping in their first fight. Hurts him with the question mark kick, and then as there's a scramble afterwards, he gets him in that one-arm guillotine. That's where Luke Rockhold does succeed. But Paulo Costa is extremely durable, can take shots to the body and to the head. I do worry about him a little bit at that kicking range, because Israel Adesanya was able to have success against Costa with the leg kick, which is something Luke Rockhold does excel at. The difference is, when Costa did move forward against Adesanya, there'd be a feint, there'd be a strike that would meet him halfway that would deter him. I don't think Luke Rockhold has the volume that can really stop Costa from moving forward, and I don't know how he's going to deal with the pressure if he isn't able to get a takedown. Maybe he could get a body lock takedown. There's just something he is pretty good at, but Paulo Costa hasn't shown poor enough takedown defense in the past for me to think, oh, Luke Rockhold's going to be able to go out there and just kind of Tim Boach him, just outclass him in a lot of different areas, look like the much more technical guy, because Paulo Costa's knockout power is almost a disservice to how technical he is. Like, Jerry West said that about Kevin Durant: you're a great scorer, Kevin, so people are never going to care about the other parts of your game. Paulo Costa's a pretty technical fighter for being this big muscle-bound guy who you think just goes in there and throws big hooks.
Matt, for Luke Rockhold, I mean, he was supposed to stick on Sean Strickland last year, out due to what was described as herniated disc. He had the shin issue. Was it a check kick in the Romero fight? Seemed like it was, and then the surgery went a little awry. But if you do look at it, for this camp, he's been training at AKA, at Killcliff FC, formerly Sanford MMA, as well as Ruka Sport with Jason Perillo. Jason Perillo, coach in Marlon Vera, coach Michael Bisping to a title. Michael Bisping, Luke Rockhold, actually training in real
life. They're boys now. It's weird.
Yeah, it's weird as Luke Rockhold's hands. Not like Uncle Jack, but still pretty weird. Matt, Costa open -260 favorite, -284 right now on best fight odds. For Luke Rockhold, open +222. +225 as it stands. We have a look at Tapology. The Tapology votes are a surprise to us there to you. But like a lot of these fights, I'm going to say over under 85% Paulo Costa.
I'll say over.
I'm going to say over. It is over. 914 total votes, 89% Costa, 91% by knockout for the 11% that have Rockhold, 41% by decision, 27% by knockout, 25% by submission. I would think Luke Rockhold would want to grapple in a matchup like this, but I don't think he is going to. I think he's going to strike, and I think Paulo Costa is going to beat him in the striking.
I'm sorry, but this is a terrible fucking matchup for Luke Rockhold. Like, you could have given him a lot of other guys in the top 15 of the middleweight division, and he probably would have looked good against
Brad Tavares. Make him fight Brad Tavares.
A guy who has, you know, a good skill set, who's foundationally sound.
He just got beat pillar to post.
He
and
did by
like
Dreykus Duplessis. But you get the idea. If you did
Edmund Shahbazyan. Give him
well, Edmund hasn't looked good for a while either. So if you did like Duplessis, though, is a good example. Like, Duplessis has good power, but he's kind of wild. He's very awkward. He's the type of guy that Luke Rockhold could take advantage of with his grappling. With Paulo, he's not very unbalanced when he throws his shots, and that's what Luke Rockhold relies on to get his takedowns. He's not a traditional wrestler to where he gets a single leg and chain wrestles you to the cage and then double legs you from there. He relies on guys being off balance. He'll trip them up. He likes a lot of takedowns from the clinch. And Paulo Costa, his physical strength does help him a lot in those clinches. And he's very offensive from the clinch, too. He likes the uppercut. He likes the left hook. These are all strikes that have hurt Luke Rockhold in the past. Even go back to his title-winning fight against Jacare. We're going way back to Strikeforce. He got hurt every time Jacare landed on with power on him. The difference was Rockhold had enough volume at that time to still make it competitive on the feet, and he was able to win the decision. I don't think he's going to have that luxury against Costa. I think he's going to get hit with a lot of body shots. And the reason I brought up the weight just problem for both guys is because Costa had his last fight at 205. Does anybody remember when Luke Rockhold sounded like he had rocks in his throat when he weighed in against Yoel Romero and openly admitted, like, hey, this weight cut is killing me now? I said this about Dan Hooker when he went from featherweight to lightweight and then back to featherweight. Cutting weight doesn't get easier as you age, and you normally change divisions for a reason. There's a reason Luke Rockhold went up to 205 to fight Jan Blachowicz. It was because the weight cut was getting very difficult for him at 185, so I'm a little worried about what version of Rockhold we're going to get at 37, almost 38 years of age, going back down to 185. I think that's going to be an interesting talking point for this
fight. What did Rockhold dirtier, the weight cut to 185 or the fact that he ends the Strikeforce era as the champ? He's supposed to fight for the title, and they went, hey, here's Vitor Belfort. Good luck.
Goes for the Wild West pre-USADA Vitor Belfort days, and boy, did he look good in that fight.
Vitor Belfort. Go back and watch the fights, because they are the highlight reel. Both of us going with Paulo Costa, the eraser, to get the win in this matchup. Big-time main event. 6 years, 8 months, and one day in the making. We have Kamaru Usman taking on Leon Edwards. Both guys on incredible roles. You're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fightin' Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Coming up this weekend in the main event of UFC 278, a rematch 6 years, 8 months, and one day in the making, we have the Nigerian Nightmare, Kamaru Usman, taking on Leon Rocky Edwards. And since their first pairing, UFC Fight Night, RDA versus Cowboy number 2 for the belt, Kamaru Usman's gone 13-0, and Leon Edwards has gone 9-0 with 1-0 contest, and it's been absolute greatness out of both of these two guys, man. I mean, for Kamaru, he gets a win over Tyron Woodley. He's off to the races. I mean, a couple of wins over Colby Covington. A couple of wins that he has on his record over Jorge Masvidal. One of them unnecessary. One of them on short notice. And for Leon Edwards, it's been a slow progression of the wins. And I mean, some of my favorites on the highlight reel. The win over Gunnar Nelson. The win that he has over RDA, where he out-wrestled Rafael Dos Anjos? It really did happen. And for Edwards, obviously the no contest 2 fights ago against Bilal Muhammad, where he was looking good until he stuck his hand out there with his fingers. He looked very, very good in his last fight against Nate Diaz if it was a 4-round fight. And in the 5th round, Nate Diaz can throw on his highlight reel before he fights Khamzat Chimaev, because you know the UFC will do that to try and build a name off Leon Edwards. Anything to build off Leon Edwards. But Leon looked really, really good in the first 4 rounds of that fight. Now, 5-round atmosphere, Usman, Edwards. What happened the first time these two guys fought? Well, Kamaru Usman went, hey, I wrestled in college, and I'm going to wrestle in this matchup. And that's pretty well what he was able to do in that matchup. I mean, Edwards is trying to pump the jab out there. I guess I should go this way because he's a southpaw. But if you look at that one, 2 29-28s for Usman, 130-27. He goes 6 of 13 in takedown attempts, 10 minutes and 50 seconds of control time. Leon Edwards tried to do, like, in the first round, some triangles off his back, but he wasn't able to do it. Edwards, though, Team Renegade Jiu-Jitsu, you know, Tom Breeze out of that gym, you know, brother Fabian Edwards out of that gym. There are a lot of good grapplers over there in England. But when you do boil this one down, Matt, these two guys, I mean, out of the two of them, one of them fights like he did at that point, and one of them has kind of strayed away from that as he's become the champion.
Exactly. Usman still has the skill set that he had in that fight, but he's added different parts to it. Whereas Leon Edwards has just reinforced the fighter that he once was and gotten a lot better at those original skills. Like, he still is a good offensive wrestler. He still is extremely well-rounded. That's really what I should say about Leon Edwards. That was always the thing that sort of set him apart from every other fighter in the division. A lot of fighters lean very heavily to either a grappler or a striker. And of course, Leon Edwards favors the striking, but, like, he's a pretty good grappler at this stage of his career. He's very good offensively. And the Vicente Luque fight was the first one that really stood out in my mind as to, like, wow, he's striking with a guy who was very dangerous on the feet. But when that wasn't going for him, he was able to duck underneath, get the takedown, get a lot of top control in that matchup. And that was the first fight that really opened my eyes to Leon Edwards potentially being, you know, a future guy in this division. And luckily for him, he has been. And that's the other thing that you have to talk about when you talk about Leon Edwards. His skill set did not change whatsoever between 3 rounds and 5 rounds. Yes, he tired a little bit against Nate Diaz, but that's because he was absolutely putting it on him for about 23 and a half minutes in that fight. And then he throws a lazy check hook with his right hand. Nate Diaz is able to go down the middle with a straight shot and basically landed the perfect punch at the time. And to Edwards' credit, it's not like he went down from it. Like, he was hurt on his feet. Let's not get it twisted whatsoever. But Leon Edwards was able to withstand that storm. It's weird, and you might disagree with me on this, but I'd like to get your take. I think you can learn a little bit about Leon Edwards and how he's going to match up against Kamaru Usman based on that no contest to Bilal Muhammad. Bilal Muhammad's a guy who will threaten you a lot with his wrestling, will strike more with his volume than with power on the feet, but still, getting ready for a guy like Bilal Muhammad, I would imagine the training camp's very similar than getting ready for a guy like Kamaru Usman. And for the short amount of that fight that we saw, Leon Edwards is beating the brakes off Bilal Muhammad, and Bilal's looked really, really good as of late, and he may have even sort of taken that step up before the Leon Edwards fight. We just don't really know because Edwards looks so good on the opposing side from him. So do you think you can look into that fight, or maybe I'm just looking a little bit too much into the 6 minutes we saw between them?
Bilal was inviting the striking, and that was the weird thing out of it. Bilal wasn't just going, hey, I gotta go take down City like he was able to do against Wonderboy or against Luque. So if you do watch it for that, it was like, okay, well, Leon Edwards is out striking Bilal Muhammad. What much is there to gain out of it? For Kamaru Usman, again, wrestle, fights Tyron Woodley. That was just an odd fight. I mean, Woodley had kind of lost the snap to everything. And if you look at it for Usman as a champion, and if you look at it in the last 5 fights, Colby Covington almost 2.5 years ago, or just over 2.5 years ago, finishes him, beats Masvidal by decision, beats Gilbert Burns by finish in a fight where he got rocked early, rallied back, finishes him and looked really good, beats Jorge Masvidal by knockout, beats Covington his last time out. That fight was about 9 months ago for Usman. And in this, we've seen a progression in some of the boxing, going from Killcliff FC, before that Black Zillions, and now to Onyx Labs with Trevor Whitman. I'm eager to see what we get out of a full-time game plan for Usman, not just out of Black Zillions at the time when he fought Leon Edwards, to now Onyx with Whitman, getting ready for a guy like Edwards who is so well-rounded.
I think this is a weird fight, though, where if Usman has success early with his striking, it's the worst thing that could ever happen to him. I really do, because he has improved his power on the feet, and he does throw some good straight shots down the middle when he is fully committed, but there's also a lot of moments in his fights where he's just sort of wildly swinging punches, hoping that one of the power shots land. And if he does do that against Leon Edwards, who does slip punches quite well, is very sound defensively, and can land good counters on the inside, like we saw against Gunnar Nelson. He had a real short elbow in that matchup. It was a real nice strike that hurt Nelson quite a bit. I know it's a split decision. One of the most one-sided split decisions I've ever seen in my life, because Leon Edwards beat the brakes off him. But you can see areas where Edwards can have a lot of success, and I feel like that's why he's not a crazy big underdog. I know he's a plus 280, which sounds like a lot, but at this stage of Kamaru Usman's career, he's going to be a big favorite over the majority of the opponents he's in there with. He has wins not only over very popular fighters, but skilled fighters too. Like, the fact that he beat Colby Covington twice in basically 10 rounds of fighting is a very impressive task, and that's the other thing about Leon Edwards. Yes, he deserves this title shot. I'm not trying to take it away from him whatsoever, But in the division, it feels like there's a 1A, Kamaru Usman, and in large part, there is a 1B, Colby Covington, and it would be nice to see a lot of these top-tier contenders fight Covington, and if they could beat him, it's a pretty good precursor to fighting a guy like Kamaru Usman. Now, I understand a lot of guys probably wouldn't be able to make it to the title shot, but still, it would have been nice to see Leon Edwards maybe fight a full fight against a pressure wrestler like we were going to get out of that Bilal Muhammad fight. I just feel like we were robbed of some really important minutes and some really important rounds in that matchup because of the no contest, but Leon Edwards, this will be the last thing I'll say, is big for the weight class, and I think he is going to be one of the few fighters who isn't going to look all that much smaller than Kamaru Usman. Like, Masvidal did fight at lightweight at one point. That's something we do have to talk about. Gilbert Burns, you know what he did? Fought at lightweight at one point. And Colby Covington has openly said that if there was a 165-pound division, if welterweight went up to 175, he would compete at 165. So Usman has had that physicality advantage over his last few opponents, and I don't necessarily think he's going to have that in Edwards. So maybe Edwards could hang with him a little bit with the wrestling defense.
I mean, for Usman against Covington, definitely had 10 rounds against him. Usman didn't beat Covington in all 10 of those 10 rounds. So
just beat him twice throughout the 10 rounds they were together.
When you look at it for Leon Edwards, definitely bigger. You can go back and watch their stare down from their original fight.
His legs are huge.
You can go and watch it, the one that they had here recently at the press conference. But Usman is the favorite here. Open to minus 300, minus 350 right now. For Edwards, open plus 250, plus 270 or thereabouts. We have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. Surprised to say to you, Kamaru Usman's pretty big favorite. And there's actually something that we do instead of Tapology votes in the main events. We have a look at the YouTube community tab. So we threw it out there not that long ago, so the votes, not that many of them, but we said main event UFC 278 rematch at welterweight. Who's getting the win? 548 total votes, 73% Usman. Bill is saying in the comments, Usman won the first match. I think he's going to take the second too. Both fighters made improvements, but I think Usman's made the bigger improvements. Paul, minus 340 for one of the goats in his prime, is popping popcorn. We've got Carnage. I favor Usman of beating... People are sleeping on Edwards. When the fight is closer than they expect, they'll be surprised when they shouldn't. Chu is saying Edwards doesn't really stand a chance. I disagree. Just another is saying Leon Scott's going to beat Usman. There's a lot of spelling going on right here, Matt. There is a lot going on. And y'all got to stop sleeping on Usman is one of the other ones. I don't know who the hell is sleeping on Kamaru Usman. Topology votes, 81% Usman on 913 total votes.
This is the last thing I'll say about Kamaru Usman because he is reaching this stage of his career.
He's 35.
One of these nights! One of these nights, Father Time is going to catch up to Kamaru Usman. And he is a very athletic MMA fighter. And what normally fades first? Your skill set, which basically lasts you until the end of time because that's knowledge you've acquired, or your athleticism, which does fade as you get older. Your athleticism. So at a certain point, I do think Usman is going to start to slow down. So let's say we do get, and I don't think this is going to happen. The pick is Kamaru Usman, but still, I think that there is a possibility that maybe we only get like an 85% of Usman. Maybe he isn't as explosive with some of those takedown attempts. He can't complete all of them. It's just sort of forcing both guys to work more on the feet. I think that does favor Edwards more and more, being the more youthful guy and having good cardio himself. But I do still like Kamaru Usman in this matchup with his wrestling. I think his wrestling might be good enough to make this fight sort of stale, if I'm being honest, because if he does have trouble on the feet, he's going to go back to that well over and over again.
Yeah, I mean, for people out there, I just said this here recently, like, if you're going to watch tape, go back and watch 4, 5, 6, 7 years ago, but just, like, to watch it. Like, you can't really gauge it. And put a ton of stock on fights that were that long ago. Now, their first matchup was 2015, so you can go back and watch it and gain a little bit here or there, but realize Leon Edwards has improved, Kamaru Usman's changed up his striking. If you go back and watch that fight, it's not fun to watch. It's a lot of Kamaru Usman closing the gap, getting it against the fence, going for the takedown, landing strikes from top position. Edwards gets back up, tries to kind of finagle some triangle attempts. Usman gets out of the triangle, lands more ground and pound. They get back up, then the next round starts, and it's more of the same. It's not really the best fight to go back and watch, but you can gain from Edwards, where we've seen him out-wrestle RDA, the smaller guy. We saw him hang in the grappling against a great grappler in Gunnar Nelson, a guy who, look at what he did against Takashi Sato here recently in the comeback. So for Edwards, he did look very good in those positions, and of course the striking is a strong suit, whereas Kamaru has gained in his boxing. A little bit wild with some of the striking, but in terms of the power, you know that it's there. He's been earning finishes as a champion, which is better than a champion just trying to fight to hold his belt. So I do expect Kamaru Usman to get the win this weekend, but I think Leon Edwards is a decent underdog, like a moderate underdog. He's got a pretty good shot because he's really pieced all of his game together, and if somebody's going to beat Usman, Leon Edwards is the somebody out of the field.
The only issue I do have with Edwards having, like, a very super clear path to victory is if he was, like, 10% more heavy-handed, then maybe some of the shots he lands are able to hurt Usman a little bit more. That is the problem with Edwards. The technique's very crisp. He seems to have knockdown power, but we've yet to see very dominant knockout power from him. So maybe we will see that because Usman does leave some of those openings. I think this will be a fun fight, although I do admit that Usman's wrestling might make it slightly stale.
Yeah, I mean, I think Edwards has a giant shot as the underdog here, but both of us going with your champion for the and still 2 hours before the prelims this weekend, we have question mark kicks. You can join that. We offer up the final pick prediction for the week with the, you know, we get the opportunity to look at the week as it is, see the weigh-ins on Friday. We also have the sidekick, which is live during the main card, so we get a chance to talk about the picks. We get a chance to hit it up in the chat with you. You can join in the action over there. We watch the fights. We score the fights. We have all sorts of fun during the fights. Matt, it's a channel all about the fights. What do you think about that?
It is. We talk about them quite a bit if you guys haven't figured it out yet. I think this should be a really fun card. Hopefully you guys enjoyed the breakdown because there are a lot of sort of hidden gems on this card that on initial review you don't really think are all that special, and then you start thinking to yourself, oh wait, I get to watch Jose Aldo fight this weekend, so I think this pay-per-view should be a fun one. A
lot of fun fights that are out there at Fight Night Picks on Twitter and Instagram. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.